Hi, everybody. We are live. Hopefully you enjoyed the fish. Man, it was a good fish show.
Oh, I forgot in the pre-flight I skipped over the pre-show item. If we don't have anything for the pre-show, you can mention it just to drain the last little bit of them. But if not, whatever.
That's not a pre-show item. That's a merch
not,
item.
Well, it's a,
the merch
maybe,
is not a
whatever.
Pre-show.
It's not a pre-show, but it is in that slot in the document when I usually read it, but I forgot to this time.
Is our bickering about this now the pre-show?
No.
By the way, I'm sorry. I'm a little bit hoarse tonight, and I wish I had a good reason, like being sick or, you know, having to shout to, you know, save a child or something. But no,
is shouting save children? Is that how it works now?
I don't know. The truth is that I am alone in my house tonight, and therefore a lot of singing has occurred. and I regret to inform you that I have neither the singing range of Paul Simon nor Art Garfunkel. And tried both. So here I am. That's the real reason why I sound slightly hoarse tonight.
I was going to say, if you were listening to the fish, how are you doing any singing?
Right?
I also listen to other music sometimes.
All right.
I mean, not a lot, if I'm honest. Sometimes.
Oh, man. It's funny to me how you tactically deploy your executive assistant for media acquisition purposes. We probably should keep this just for the bootleg, but
Whenever
I want
to pirate anything, I always ask Casey how to do it, because like, I haven't pirated things
I don't know what you're talking about.
in a very long time, like since high school, really. Like, so all the modern ways to do it, I don't really know about them, and I'm certainly not like set up for them. So I always have to ask my other friends, like, hey, there's this like concert I want to download, and it's only letting me do like a video on demand. How do I download it?
Indeed. But yeah, I got a text message out of the blue saying, hey, there's this time limited thing I really want to download. What can I do? And yeah, I gave some pointers as to thing, just hypothetical things that one could try, but we would never do. But
no,
you could try them. And it turns out that you didn't need my help because you found it by a mechanism all your own. But it was,
well,
it still
someone
did
else sent
me.
It to me, basically. But I think it's interesting, like, you know, in the history of like things that can be shown in a web browser, typically there were tools that were pretty reliably able to download those things, you know, because it's like at some level it would be like, you know, a bunch of MPEG-4 files in a series on a server in a playlist or something like that. But now there appears to be pretty widespread use of whatever kind of DRM, I think maybe Widevine is one of them, but whatever kind of DRM exists now on HLS streams, it seems like it's everywhere now. And so all the tools like, you know, YouTube DL or YTDLP or whatever, like all these tools basically don't work anymore on a lot of like paid video services because they all use this DRM, which is on one level, you know, it's, I'm not a fan of DRM as a technologist. So, you know, that irritates me on a lot of levels. But I'm also just kind of surprised that like none of these tools have caught up yet. Cause like, it seems like, I mean, I don't know how this stuff works these days. I'm sure there's a lot of OS level integrations, but like somehow every web browser, including stuff like Firefox, like they can all play the DRM streams just fine. And screen recording software can, you, like, that is still a loophole. You can still like run a screen recording, not with all apps. Like QuickTime Player will just give you like a black square, but some apps will just record the screen in some way that includes the content. So you can do it that way, which is a terrible way to do it, I know, but like I'm kind of amazed that all these tools are not able to break this DRM for something that is common enough that it can play in every web browser. But I don't know, it we live in kind of a sad time that there's just that much DRM everywhere in our computing lives now, and we don't even like blink an eye. It's just considered normal. It's kind of sad.
Indeed. All right, so do we have an actual pre-show we can do?
That might have been it.
No, we shouldn't. No, we should not do that as the pre-show. That's for the bootleg, man. It's a teaser for the bootleg.
Are you talking about fish stuff? I thought all that was free, man.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's never. So they post free stuff to you. So the way fish stuff works.
Free as in freedom.
No, it's not. And I don't need it to be free. Like I buy the MP3. Like you can buy audio downloads that are all DRM free.
That's what I was saying. Like you pay the money and you get a bunch of files, but they're DRM free.
That's audio only, though. If you want to see the video streams, you pay per show something like $40, and then you can watch the stream for like 48 hours or, you know, and or live.
That's weird. Why do they make that distinction?
But then the real problem is you can't buy it afterwards. Like, no. So you can watch it for only the 48 hours, like after the concert has occurred. But if you want to watch it next week or next year, you just can't. Like, you can't rebuy it. There's no way to watch it. It's just gone. So, and it was, this Phish New Year show was a really important show. Like,
it was important.
explain yourself. Use more words.
I'm not even going to try to explain, but basically there was a ton of fan service, you know, things like references that go back 30 years in the band, like that were brought together in a big way. And so it was a very important show for Phish fans. And so I wanted to really make sure, like, I really want to have a copy of this in case, like, because look, I don't know what the band's archival situation is. I assume that they are saving all of their videos and at some point in the future might make them available in some way, maybe, I hope. But I don't want to rely on maybe, I hope, for like a really important concert for my favorite band of my life. Like, I want to actually have it.
This is where the community comes in, though. Like, couldn't you just rely on the fact that this is a popular band and you don't have to do this? All you got to do is wait for the people who already know how to do this to upload the stream that they ripped from the thing?
Yeah, but upload it where? That's the problem. Like, I don't know all the places that people
go.
I really hope
Adam can help you in your old age.
I know. He's going to have to. Right now, Casey is my video piracy assistant. Eventually, Adam will take over and help both of us. But we're not there yet.
That's not piracy if you paid for it and you're just time shifting it. I think we already had several court cases about that, and the VCR was allowed to exist. So if you pay for something, like if you pay for cable television and they air it and send it to you and you record it on a device, I know you've got the DMCA with the you're not supposed to crack encryption, blah, 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 but I feel like you're at least ethically, if not legally, in the clear here.
Well, I think it's a little questionable, and we'll get to copyright stuff later, actually, but I think it's a little questionable because, like, I'm not paying $40 to own it forever. I'm paying $40 to watch it once.
I know, but it's the same thing when you pay for cable. You're not paying to own all those shows that are broadcast to your house forever, but you do pay the cable company to send you video. And if you have a device in your home that records that video for time-shifting purposes, like a video cassette recorder, that turns out to be legal according to all the court cases. The only wrinkle in this entire scheme is, oh, now we have a thing called DRM that stops you from recording it, and because of the DMCA, it's illegal for you to try to crack DRM. And I think there is no distinction between paying for cable to be broadcast in your house and then time shifting with VCR, and then paying for a video of a concert to be streamed into your house and then time shifting it with FFmpeg, right? The only difference is that stupid law that says you're not allowed to even try to crack encryption, which is incredibly stupid and we should get rid of, but it is what it is.
I mean, there's a whole lot of this that's stupid, but I don't think that necessarily would hold up to legal scrutiny. Like,
because of the DMCA, because it's illegal to try to crack encryption. But aside from that one thing, it is exactly the same as the time shifting with a VCR case. Because in both cases, like, well, you just paid to have it sent to your house once. You didn't pay to keep it forever. But the courts found, no, if you have a device that can record it, it's yours.
Is that really what the decision? I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, the whole point was, like, you can't have a video cassette recorder in your house because then when we air Star Wars on ABC and you record it, now you have a copy of Star Wars and you didn't pay for that. And the decision was, you're allowed to do that. You're not allowed to resell it. You're not allowed to sell tickets to it or whatever,
yeah,
but you were allowed to time shift. It was called time shifting. You take something that was aired and you put it on some storage medium so you can watch it at a different time. And the only legal thing stopping you now is they made a law that says, okay, if we put some magic pixie dust DRM on this, even if it's trivially easy to crack, if you do that, you're breaking the law. That's why you had the DCSS t-shirts with the pearl code on it that illegal and all that crap,
like the one prime number that broke the key or whatever.
It's absurd, but that is the legal system we have. That's why I said ethically I think you're in the clear, if not legally.
I wonder if, like, if a screen recording method might actually sort of not be a DMCA. I don't know.
Because you didn't try to crack the encryption, probably.
But you could argue, like, the software might have cracked it. But
it's not compliant or whatever.
But it's just recording the screen contents, so, like, it's not...
Yeah, I think that's probably fine, because I think that it's like the analog loophole. Remember that whole thing of, like, oh, the way to record it is, you know, you're not cracking the encryption on the DVD. You're just playing the DVD over an analog video cable and then intercepting it there.
Yeah, I mean, all of the, machinations now about... like how having these secure video paths that are supported by the hardware and HDMI and everything, and trying to ensure DRM so that you can't do stuff like screen recording or just HDMI capture of
or take content. A screenshot because you want to tweet something funny about a TV show. The worst.
I know. Like, the worst. But, and I, frankly, I don't actually know how certain screen recording methods somehow get around it and others don't. That's I'm glad they do, but like the amount of grief this causes legitimate users all the time. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've traveling and trying to output something over HDMI to a TV or something, and some part of the chain doesn't fit the DRM's standards, and so it just refuses, and I guess I can't watch this movie that I paid for, like, stream from my laptop onto the hotel TV or whatever. Like, it's so annoying.
It's dumb because, as we all know, none of that stuff actually stops the stuff from being available illegally. All it does is frustrate legitimate users.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh, DRM, you know, sucks.
I think we talked about this just a couple months ago because I just ran across this recently, but there is a website, a Dave Matthews Band fan website, where it has a Q&A with the crew. Now, this may be very, very old. But somebody asked, you have listed a 24-track hard disk recorder under the recording equipment, but 39 inputs to the board. Do you mix channels or record on multiple, 24-track recorders, blah, 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 blah. The answer is we actually have 8 Tascam 24s, 3 pairs working in main and backup modes with 2 spares. 46 tracks are recorded every day, which includes the band's input list plus several audience mics and other inputs. The hard drives get sent back to an archivist in Charlottesville who then dumps each track to a separate CDR for permanent storage in a vault. Each show will generate about 138 CDRs, and that's audio. That's not even video.
Did
so
we discuss this already?
We did. And did. I said we did.
Freak out about
we did.
CDRs.
Yeah, they better be using discs.
Yep. Yeah, because I really think putting them on a CDR and then putting them in a vault are two sentiments that are a little bit at odds with each other.
I totally agree with you, but my point is, Marco had justifiably asked, is this a flash in the pan? This video recording, does Fish keep a copy of this video recording, or is this a one and done?
I mean, I assume someone is archiving all this stuff.
Agreed.
I hope.
I would hope so,
but
as well.
I don't know.
You never know.
Like, they don't usually release archival videos. Like, they release archival audio sometimes. I don't think they tend to release archival video much, if at all. So I don't know. That's why, like, it's a little unnerving, and that's why I think a lot of sympathy from the two of you on this. I want to be a digital pack rat for stuff that I can't just easily just get off the internet again. Like, stuff that's really important to me. I actually want to have my own copy, because we all know from the tech world that everything out there that's, like, especially DRM stuff through streaming services or whatever, it's all so temporary. You think you own it, even when you buy it and you think you, quote, own it, then, Sony pulls a fast one or something like that, a story, and, like, then it's just gone. The stuff you, quote, bought is gone or unavailable or whatever. Like, so, and that stuff annoys me so much. I think we live in a time where a huge amount of modern culture, in the form of both media and also like software and games and everything like that, a huge amount of it is going to be basically inaccessible to historians in the future because of technological means or encryption or SSL breaking or whatever. Like, there's so many things that like the previous eras of media that we've had. Decades ago, we can all still access those today, but the stuff that we are making and using and enjoying today, I think we're going to have a very hard time re-enjoying or re-experiencing that in 20 years.
Yeah, I think it's probably mostly the trend line is upward still, because all the stuff before recorded medium is totally lost. People sang and there was nothing to record them on for most of human history. And then we had this period where it was recorded with no DRM, and now we have it recorded with DRM, but we have so much more storage now. I think we're saving so much more stuff. It's going to be a lot easier for historians to find that old stuff. Maybe we're not saving it DRM encrypted, but even if they are, it will be eventually trivial to break that DRM encryption. So I think we're doing better overall, but there is definitely a hiccup in the whole introduction of DRM that's going to cause some headaches. But it's still better than wax cylinders, and it's still way better than no way to record performances at all.
We shall see. I don't know. All right, let's do some follow-up. That is going to be the pre-show, isn't it?
Yep. All right.
Let's do some follow-up. And we have a paper about Apple's on-device LLM. LLM in a flash, efficient large language model inference with limited memory. Can you tell me about this, please, John?
I think it was last episode we were talking, maybe the Ask ATP question, about what we thought Apple would do to run LLM stuff on device with wimpy devices like the HomePod. And we referenced this, alluded to this paper, but we didn't have a link to it. So now we will in the show notes. This is a summary from someone on Threads. It says, Apple has proposed an inference cost model that coordinates with the behavior of flash memory usage, guiding optimization in two key areas, reducing the amount of data transferred from flash memory and reading data in larger, more continuous blocks. These methods collectively enable running models up to twice the size of available DRAM with 4x to 5x and 20x to 25x increase in inference speed compared to naive loading approaches in CPU and GPU, respectively. So this is, you can read the paper to see, but it's like, hey, Apple has a bunch of devices that have limited DRAM, and if you wanted to run one of those better models, then you can't fit it in DRAM. Is there a way you can get reasonable performance out of it while essentially overflowing your RAM and using flash as a backing store? And they have some techniques to speed that up, and that is extremely relevant to pretty much everything that Apple makes, with the exception of Macs, where you are probably going to be RAM limited. And a lot of these large language models, I know the first L is for large, but you can size them. You can even, in a lot of the cases, take a really big honking model that takes a huge amount of resources and take that exact model and cut it down in some way, like without like making a new model, to size it to fit within whatever your constraints are. And it sounds like this approach in this paper would let Apple use models a little bit bigger than they otherwise would be able to on their wimpy hardware.
Good deal. Apple is also exploring AI deals with news publishers. This was in the New York Times. Apple has opened negotiations in recent weeks with major news and publishing organizations seeking permission to use their material in the company's development of generative artificial intelligence systems. According to four people familiar with the discussions, the technology giant has floated multi-year deals worth at least $50 million to license the archives of news articles, said the people with knowledge of talks. For the record, Apple, for 10% of that, for a mere $5 million, you are welcome to use CaseyList.com in its entirety in training your model. Just
I thought you were going to offer up the ATP archives. I think we need to collectively negotiate with Apple for those, even though they're already publicly available. We may have started at a disadvantage in this negotiation already.
Fair. But have your people call our people.
Yeah. So this is something that a few companies are doing. Adobe is the other one that comes to mind, where they have a bunch of generative AI stuff in the latest version of Photoshop that I believe Adobe has claimed, hey, we trained all of our models on images that we own or have the rights to. So they're essentially legally in the clear. If it's not Adobe and it's actually some other like stock photo company, I forget. But anyway, companies are doing this where they're like, we want to be able to provide a service to our customers with no doubt, no legal doubt. But however this whole, you know, court stuff comes out with the AI training, it's like we trained our models on stuff that we own, because some companies own a large volume of images, for example, like a stock photo company or whatever. It might be the stock photo company I'm thinking of. Not what is it called? Shutterstock? Or maybe it's
something like that.
No, not that one.
Getty Images.
Yeah. Anyway, Apple, this is totally an Apple move to say, we can solve this problem with money. If there's any kind of questions about the legality, how about we just give people millions of dollars in exchange for them letting us train their train our AI model on their content?
Exactly. The New York Times, speaking of, is suing OpenAI and Microsoft for copyright infringement. The New York Times is suing OpenAI and Microsoft for copyright infringement, claiming the two companies built their AI models by copying and using millions of the publication's articles and now, quote unquote, directly compete with its content as a result. As outlined in the lawsuit, the Times alleges OpenAI and Microsoft's large language models, which power ChatGPT and Copilot, can generate output that recites Times content verbatim, closely summarizes it, and mimics its expressive style. This undermines and damages the Times' relationship with readers, the outlet alleges, while also depriving it of subscription licensing, advertising, and affiliate revenue. Whoopsie-doopsie.
That nicely ties in above the previous story. If Apple is offering these people millions of dollars for the content, but Microsoft is just taking it for free and then getting sued over it, you can see where Apple might have thought this is a wiser move in the short term. We've talked about this many times in the past. About whether it is, you know, again, ethics, morals, and legalities, whether it is right to train a large language model on, for example, the publicly accessible web pages containing content of New York Times stories. People can make arguments that it is, it's transformational and it's, you know, fair use or whatever legal precedent you'd want to use for it, or it's an entirely new thing. We have to have a new set of laws governing or whatever. But clearly the New York Times thinks, hey, if you train your large language model on New York Times articles and now people use your thing and don't ever go to the New York Times because they essentially get the article summarized or excerpted in your thing or whatever, that's, you know, under current law, that's illegal, and now we're suing you over it or whatever. as I said in many past times when we discuss this, I continue to think that it should not be legal to train a large language model on content that you don't own, because your large language model is worthless without that content. Empty large language model that has not been trained on anything is worth $0. And you can say, well, we can make this valuable by feeding it the contents of the New York Times. Well, the New York Times, you should either let you do that, or they should be compensated for it, or we need to figure out some other thing. But I don't think you should just get it free just because. But that's the type of thing that is going to be hashed out in court. And again, Apple is neatly sidestepping this by saying, I don't care whether it's legal or not. Here's millions of dollars. Can we use your articles? Yes, no. And that is a much more straightforward arrangement of value exchange. What is the right amount of money for that? Is it like, a penny per article, or like even less? Or like what, how people who are training large language models negotiate with people who own the content that they're being trained on? We'll see. There's always sort of publicly available things, like I think Wikipedia says you're allowed to train on it, but whether they do or not, everybody does. This is entirely in a big legal gray area, and I think Apple's approach is the right one for now, and Adobe and whatever company I couldn't remember that's also doing the same thing. Train on data that you own or have licensed, and then if it turns out that, actually the courts say you're allowed to get this for free, then don't pay them next year. But if it turns out that the New York Times wins their case and gets millions of dollars in damages, you were always on the right side of that. So kudos to Apple for using its money wisely.
Yeah, this is a case to watch because there's been so many kind of questions about AI training and its relation to copyright law, and is training an AI on public material that that's owned by somebody else, is that copyright infringement? I don't know if that's a clear-cut argument either way. Like, it is, it's definitely like a new area, and this is what happens with the law over time. Like, new problems arise, or new conditions, or new distinctions need to be made, and that's what the law and the legal system is made to sort out and decide. It remains a huge open question mark of, like, can you just train AI models on whatever you want? I still believe that that is not copyright infringement necessarily, because, like, if you look at, the New York Times is making some pretty, strong claims here that, these LLMs that they tested were able to output Times articles verbatim. But if you look at what kind of prompts they had to give them, the way it worked was basically the New York Times would feed it like the first few paragraphs of an article and say what comes next. And so the way LLMs work on a general, a general high level overview of the way LLMs work is basically, like, statistically speaking, what comes next given this prompt. And so when they give it a few paragraphs of a story from the New York Times verbatim and say what comes next after this, they're is probably no other statistical influence on what the model could draw from. So of course it's going to say, okay, well, the one source I saw that contained everything you're asking for, this was next.
Now, I think part of that demonstration, part of the point of that demonstration is to do something that is otherwise difficult to do, which is essentially to prove that they did train on your data. Because it's not like when you see an LLM, you can ask it, hey, tell me all the stuff that you ingested. It doesn't work that way. They can't answer that question. It's not like they're trying to keep it a secret. A large language model does not contain within it a complete exhaustive list of all the data that it was trained on, right? I mean, it does in sort of a smushed up fuzzy way, but not like in a literal way. So if as part of the case, if I don't know if this is in this particular case, but if as part of the case, the people with the LLM said, we never trained on your data, you can pull this out and say, I think it's pretty unlikely that it would produce these verbatim, seven paragraphs, right? So there's that. And I don't know in this case. Again, Microsoft could freely admit that they trained from the New York Times, and that's a moot point. But the language in the little summary we excerpted from is directly trying to tie it to existing law, because that's what they have to do in a court case. If there are no laws directly addressing this, you're going to come and say, I think you are in violation of these existing laws. And so one of those is like the whole fair use doctrine of like, is the thing a substitute for the thing that it is taking from? And like saying like a 2-second clip of a movie is not a substitute for the movie. No one is saying, I was going to watch the movie, but instead I'm going to watch this 2-second clip, right? And they're saying that these LLMs directly compete with its content, saying it is a substitute. It is directly competing with our stuff. It's not just like, a Google search result where you see a headline and you see like a link and then like two sentences, but you have to click through to read the story. No one is looking at that and saying, well, I felt like I've read the whole story. Where it's here, they're saying, you know, within existing copyright law, you do not fall under this section of fair use because you are directly competing with us rather than just, you know, not being a substitute or whatever. So we'll see if they succeed in that strategy, because to your point, Marco, the existing laws don't address this because it's a new use case. But that's when you bring a case, you have to say, I think some existing laws you're already in violation of. And we'll see how that works out legally. My point has always been, regardless of what the current laws say, I think it shouldn't be legal. So that to do what they're doing just willy-nilly. So there should be some kind of law made governing this. Or and if laws aren't made governing it, then at the very least, what we'll get is precedents in court cases. I don't like things being determined by precedents in court cases, because I forget what the saying is. I always get it backwards, but like hard cases make bad law or something like that, where it's better to just say what you actually want to happen through legislation. And to the degree that our government can actually function, that would be the more desirable thing. But anytime any laws are made surrounding technology, we all kind of, grit our teeth a little bit. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. I mean, because I don't think it's that clear cut. Their claims, you know, they say that it can recite Times content verbatim. Okay, we covered that. Like, but there's already laws against that. Reciting Times content verbatim is copyright infringement. That's direct, because it's like, this is a copyrighted work that we have on our site, and you are serving it over here. We already have laws that make that part of it illegal. They also say it closely summarizes it. Well, who cares? That's not illegal.
I don't know. I'm not sure if it depends on how close the summary is. I think existing laws, listing case laws, probably covers cases where it's like, well, it's not exactly verbatim. One or two words are changed here. But I'm not, I don't have exhaustive knowledge of copyright law. But that seems like something that would have come up before. For example, a newspaper essentially stealing another newspaper story and reproducing it high school student style, where you change a couple words around. There have been cases about that. Again, in all those cases, here's the tricky bit and the part I always keep trying to focus on. In all existing case law, it's humans doing things like this. Like, it's a reporter at one newspaper closely summarizing an article in another newspaper and changing the words around, right? Whereas here, it's not a human doing this. It's humans setting a machinery into motion, and the machinery spits out the New York Times article that it was fed in this series of things. So the laws governing what machines are allowed to do are much more sparse and less well tested, because they're all necessarily newer, because we haven't had machines that could do anything like this. So yeah, it's hard to say how this one's going to go, but like I applaud Apple for just sidestepping it entirely, and Adobe and all these other companies, while these guys fight it out. But I do fear what the outcome of these cases are going to be, because it's like, what, you know, whatever the details of this specific case are probably so weird and so specific that they shouldn't be like the placeholder for everything for all time. It would be much better for us to all sort of think about this as a society and come up with some kind of guidelines that we think will be beneficial going forward. But the more I outline that scenario, the more fantastical it sounds. So maybe we'll just get a series of legal precedents and hope for the best.
Well, and there's other ways this could be sorted out. So, like, for instance, you know, the market might kind of go in a direction where, like, big companies like OpenAI and Microsoft, and certainly as we're seeing with what Apple's allegedly doing, big companies might decide, you know what, it's not worth the risk for me to train my models on data that might come back and bite me in the butt as a copyright infringement lawsuit later. So let me just, you know, buy stuff from you know, known sources that I'm allowed to buy from anyway and train on that.
Or they'll settle out of court. Like, this will never actually go to a verdict. They'll settle once they see the lay of the land in the court, and whoever's losing will be compelled to come to the table and they'll find a settlement. And basically what they'll end up with is a not quite as amicable version of what Apple has, which is, you know, Microsoft has agreed to play the New York Times X, Y millions of dollars in exchange for blah, 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 blah. And that becomes the precedent, which is like, if you can steal it, if you can get away with it, but if they notice and sue you, then you have to settle for millions of dollars, which is also not a great way to do business. See also patents.
Right. But also, like, you know, the models, I know shockingly little about how these new models work, so forgive me. Trying to figure that out in the coming year. But anyway, the models could also potentially be tweaked to just, like, kind of keep track of, like, how many original training inputs are being served for a given output, maybe?
Yeah, that's not how the models work at all right now. Like, at all. It's more, it's much more like a one-way hash mash. You cannot reverse it. You could keep, they don't, you could keep track of, like, what did we train it on, but maybe either, you know, accidentally or on purpose, a lot of these companies say, oh, well, we can't give you an exhaustive list of what we train. Like, just humans, like, hey, we'll just make a list of all the stuff we feed to the LLM. Like all the URLs, all the content, we'll essentially catalog it. And so if anyone asks, we can show them the list. But what you're asking for is what a lot of people ask for. Is like, oh, when I give you a prompt and you give me a result, can you tell me what contributed to that result? Because the answer is always everything I was trained on. Like, that's the answer. There's no like, oh, tell me which part did this word come from and what URLs and what documents contributed to this. That is absolutely not tracked in these things. And if you think about it, if it was, like, that's, you know, it's not... If it was, these models would be even larger. Now, it could be that legally we have to come up with some kind of tagging method to be able to incorporate that into the model so it can tell you. But I bet the answer would be these 17 million documents contributed to that result. And it's like, that's not useful to me. How is that useful? So, yeah, I don't – this whole lawsuit of like, New York Times is suing OpenAI, right? Whichever way this goes – those large language models at OpenAI were not just trained on the New York Times. They were trained on millions and millions and millions of pieces of data. Is this the system now, if you can figure out that it was trained on your data and you can hire lawyers for millions of dollars, you can sue them and hope to win something? Like, that's also a ridiculous system.
Yeah, I mean, I think my general opinion on it now is that it shouldn't be illegal for AI models to do what will be legal for humans to do. So,
why do you think that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of this is really questions about fair use, which of course is a famously squishy, imprecise doctrine. But it is totally legal for a human to read a bunch of New York Times articles and then and summarize them for other people if they ask them.
Right,
it is
but
legal
humans
for
have
a
rights.
Human, well, it is legal for a human to. You know, like what the Times says that the models, quote, mimic its expressive style. Well, it is totally legal for a human to mimic the New York Times' style when creating other content. The Times does not have a monopoly on style.
I'm not entirely sure it is legal for humans to closely summarize. But anyway, my whole point of this is like, yes, our laws give humans lots of rights, but this is not a human doing this. It is essentially
but it is tools that humans are making.
Right, but that's like making it sort of a rights laundering machine where it's like, well, if I make a machine and set it into motion, I wash my hands of it and now I didn't do it. The computer program did it, but computer programs have no rights. They're not sentient conscious beings that have legal standing in the legal system. They are computer programs, right? There are no laws saying, and if a computer program does this, it's fine because the computer programs are allowed to do that because here are the rights. Here's the Bill of Rights for computer programs. It's not a conscious entity. It's not a, you know what I mean? Like, so, and if you make it so like, well, if a human kills someone, that's murder. But if a human pushes a button that makes a machine kill somebody, it's fine. The machine did it. And this is just more complicated version of push the button. Machinery happens. Copyright infringement.
No, I actually don't think this is like, liability laundering at all. Like, I think it's on the contrary, the people who create the machine become responsible for what it does. But I think it should be allowed to do what people are allowed to do, because the people are the ones creating the software that does this. The people are the ones creating the tools. So, like, it is right now, it is legal for me to read a bunch of articles and then, talk about them in summary or, make a satirical imitation of the New York Times' style. That is all legal for me. However, what is not legal for me is to replicate an entire article on my own site that's someone else's. They can hit me for copyright infringement. Well, that I think is fine. And so in some ways, I think the Times actually has a case for copyright infringement, in the sense that if these models can output copyrighted content in whole, I guess that makes sense, then I think that they have a possible case there. But I don't think they could then also say you aren't allowed to train on our data. The problem is you are reserving our data, and that becomes OpenAI and Microsoft's liability then. So they have to decide what they want to do with their models and whether they can tweak them in such a way that it can't do that anymore. But the models existing and having been trained on that data, I don't see that as a clear-cut copyright violation.
I mean,
they can create
copyright
violations afterwards, but the model just having been trained on it, I don't necessarily see that as a problem.
It's not a clear-cut copyright violation, because copyright is a law that's been extended to do so many weird things. But I think it's not tenable for us to have a system where you can extract all the value from someone else's content and make something that was previously worthless, a worthless pile of code, suddenly becomes incredibly valuable because of the input of the work of others that they're not compensated for. You know what I mean? And that's why I'm saying, like, that shouldn't be allowed, because it makes for a system where one party with these LLMs can exploit the work of others with no compensation and then make huge amounts of money off of it. And that seems like it doesn't set a great precedent. I'm not sure what the system should be, but that doesn't seem like a great system. And the closest thing that we have, legally speaking, and I think there was probably cases about this, but I don't remember them, is like Google search results. Is it illegal for Google to scrape the entire web and to make a search engine? Google is worthless without the web that it's scraping, right? And if there were cases about this, which I imagine there were, because there's cases about everything, what I think the side we've come down to is, we're okay with you essentially indexing and allowing access to and showing search results for, because in the end, you are providing a service that is like a catalog that leads you to the links that you then click on. But as time has gone on and Google has gotten more and more towards the side of like, well, we don't really want to send you to the links. We found some links,
yes,
but
here's some
actually
knowledge.
What we're doing here is summarizing links. You don't need to click through. We'll just summarize them. I mean, they were doing that long before LLMs, right? And that starts to get more into, okay, Google, are you a substitute for the websites? Because previously we said it's fine for Google to make a $1 billion company and sell ads, because they're providing a service, a catalog, an index. They are not replacing all of those web pages. Google itself contains no information. If you want to see what's on those web pages, you got to click through them. Oh, well, they do have summaries. And I guess they do show the headline. Oh, now they're summarizing them at the top and not showing you what that came from? That's where you start to push into this. And if you're going to look at the closest case law and the closest argument for it, you could say, well, if you think it's okay for Google to do what they're doing, then how is this not okay? Because this is just a better version of Google. And
largely,
that's where
yes.
I think this is going to come down.
I mean, I think that largely is the case that I'm making. Like, I don't see this as being that different from what Google is doing. And what Google is doing, like, you can look at it and you can say this is not ideal. You can say this is kind of a jerk thing to do. But that's very different from whether it should be legal or not. And we already have sufficient laws to protect against, you know, full scale copyright infringement. Like Google, in their little info box answers they give on their search results pages, they aren't allowed to replicate an entire copyrightable work on there. That would be copyright infringement. We already have laws against that. They are allowed to stay within whatever is considered fair use, and again, that's a kind of a squishy, broad thing. But there are established standards for that, and including like how much of the work are you replicating. So if you are just like if you have an AI model that is able to give you a one sentence summary of a 5-paragraph article, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That I think is clear fair use.
Yeah, well, those are the ends of the spectrum, but I feel like what the LLMs are doing is far beyond the summary at the top of Google results. But that's they're creeping towards each other, right? So Google was going that direction. LLMs took this huge leap to say, actually, no search results. I mean, the old Bard does still provide them, but like I said, it's my understanding that you can't back it out of the result. You can show what you the documents that you trained on if you bothered to keep track of them, which you probably didn't because your lawyers probably said just don't keep track of it. But you can't, you know. You can't show exactly where the stuff came from, but like the LLMs, we'll see how this this case goes. Like the direct competition, like saying that this is a substitute for our service, that is an attempt to nullify fair use. To say even if you just show an excerpt or whatever, if you show sufficient information that it is now a substitute for the thing that you trained on, you're essentially stealing value from us. No one's going to go to the New York Times if all the knowledge of the New York Times is contained in your large language model. And right now, they're not that good, right? And so really, all the language isn't contained in the LLMs, and a lot of it is filled with BS or whatever. But if they could figure out how to make it not spew BS, or at least spew plausible enough BS that no one ever goes to the New York Times again, that makes the New York Times unviable as a business. And why? Because the LLMs stole all their value, and then eventually there's no more New York Times. I know this is a silly scenario, but eventually there's no more New York Times, and then what is the next LLM trained on? Which is why I think just allowing it to go hog wild is not viable. You need to come to some kind of arrangement that allows all the things that the LLMs are trained on to continue to exist for the next 100 years for the next set of LLMs or whatever to be trained on. Otherwise, they'll be just LLMs with nothing for them to be trained on except for each other's BS, and that's not an ideal system.
I mean, in all fairness, the New York Times generates a whole bunch of BS on its own. It doesn't need any help doing it.
Oh, Marco making a bold, brave stand against the New York Times. The failing New York Times, Marco says.
Oh, God.
No. Put your red hat on.
I mean, I can't point to any better press outlets. They're all
yeah, Washington Post has its moments.
Anyway, so... but no, I mean, like, ultimately, like, there's a question of what should be illegal... Also, but you know, versus what's ideal for the market or ideal for how we think things should be righteous or best, and those are very different questions. Like lots of things are legal that we think are kind of unfortunate. Lots of things are legal that are pretty, you know, strong competition for other companies. So you know, if new technology creates competition for someone else, like that's generally legal and
well what you want is for laws to laws to guide this, because if there are no laws governing it and people think it's free for all, there'll never be a market solution. What you want is there to be enough laws that say these parties need to discuss things with each other because one of them just can't take everything and ignore the other, right? If in the absence of any kind of laws or precedents or whatever, it's like, we can do whatever we want. Everything we're doing is 100% legal. You can't stop us at all. It's better to have some kind of laws governing the bounds of this such that it brings them all to the table and they come to a market solution. Because the market solution is not going to be you pay New York Times $1 for every article you trained on, because that's like billions of dollars, right? That doesn't make any sense. That's not a viable market solution. Then it'd be like, okay, well, I guess we just won't have LLMs, and I guess we'll never train the New York Times, right? If you have enough guidelines, the parties will come together and come up with something that is feasible to say, well, if we don't talk to each other and figure something out, there are these laws that say, you know, again, kind of like patents, where there's the FRAND stuff where it's like, you can have this patent, but you have to license it to people under reasonable terms. You can't just charge them $1 billion or whatever. I would hope that there'd be some kind of laws that make the LLM companies figure out a compensation model, kind of like the ASCAP thing or whatever, when you want to do like a cover of a song or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can't just cover a song for free, but also there is a system in place that has come up with a market value for doing covers such that covers still are allowed to happen, but people are still compensated for them. And I don't know a lot about that whole system, but that's, in my mind, that's kind of the ideal of, like, it's not a free-for-all, but it's also not so onerous that no one can ever sing covers anymore. And it's also, you know, people do get paid, right? So, again, maybe wishful thinking. We'll see how this works out in the court case. But I do like the idea of there being some kind of value exchange somewhere here. And I'm happy to let the market figure out that value exchange. But in the absence of any guidelines, I'm not happy to let people just say, everything is free and we're taking it all and we'll suck every ounce of value out of it. Sorry.
I mean, that's capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah, that's unbridled capitalism. We need capitalism with regulations, right? That's laissez-faire capitalism.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
It tends not to work very well long term.
The tricky part is figuring out what should those guidelines be, and who should they accidentally favor? Usually rich people.
And everyone has a different answer.
Speaking of, let's talk Massimo. So on the 26th of December, the Biden administration said, we're not going to do anything about this. And the Apple Watch sales ban did indeed land in the U.S. Apple had a statement, again, this 26th of December. Apple says, at Apple, we work tirelessly to create products and services that meaningfully impact users' lives. It's what drives our teams, clinical, design, and engineering, to dedicate years to developing scientifically validated health, fitness, and wellness features for Apple Watch. And we are inspired that millions of people around the world have benefited greatly from this product.
Hang on, just a moment here. Keep in mind, what you're reading is a statement after the Biden administration said, nah, we're going to let this go through. We've got more than halfway through this statement, and Apple has said, we're pretty great. Like, it wouldn't be like a statement, we are very disappointed with the Biden administration's blah, 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 we will blah, 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 blah. It's fully, you know, over one half of this statement is like, we just work so hard on this and we're so wonderful. Anyway, now what do they say?
We strongly disagree with the U.S. ITC decision and resulting exclusion order, and are taking all measures to return Apple Watch Series 9, Apple Watch Ultra 2 to customers in the U.S. as soon as possible. Again, 26 December.
I bet they're going to pay Massimo a bunch of money, right? All measures. Let's see what happens next.
Surely that's what they'll do. 27 December at 11:55 a.m. Apple Watch band has been temporarily paused. Woo! So The Verge reports that one day after the Apple Watch import ban went into effect, the U.S. Court of Appeals is instituting a brief pause while it considers a longer pause.
So the answer is, what avenues were still open? Still plenty of things they can do in the courts, and they are. Like, I mean, that's always been Apple's play here, is they're going to exhaust every possibility, asking Biden to help them, appealing. They'll do all those things. We'll see if they get to a termination condition, which involves giving Massimo money.
Yeah, I don't see this ending any other way than that. Like, ultimately, like, I think they're just going to have to settle, and they're going to have to license this, whatever this patent is that's like that they can't get passed.
Well, that was the 27th at 11:55 a.m., the 27th at 5:21 p.m. Apple resumes Apple Watch sales after the ban is paused. With the sales and import bans on hold, Apple's resumed sales of Series 9 and Ultra 2. So, and that's where we stand. We're recording this on, what's today, the 3rd? We still have Apple Watch on sale in the United States from Apple. So all is well.
I mean, that's right? Pretty amazing considering they halted sales like a couple days after Christmas, and then one day later they turned them back on. I mean, again, it's still winding its way through the court system. But if you had to, if Apple could have picked this timing, I'm not sure they could have picked anything better. Like, we get all our holiday sales, we get 1 or 2 days where we file paperwork to, you know, we have our last ditch effort. Biden, save us. He's like, nah, don't think so. And then it gets pulled from the stores, and then one day later, it's back. And, you know, now we wait for the next step.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out pretty well for Apple. Not so great for Massimo, but I mean,
this is not over yet. So further updates as events transpire.
Indeed. All right, let's talk 2024, baby. And we should probably do a little bit of a preview as to what we think is coming in 2024. John, you've been kind enough to put a bunch of items in the show notes for us to discuss. Did you want to do this top to bottom, or are you going to let us just round robin and pick what we think is interesting?
No, I mean, we can go through the items. What I put on the list is things, well, it's in our typical show notes fashion. It's things that we more or less know are coming and what we think about them, or we're looking forward to them, whatever. And then things start getting question marks after them as we get towards the end of the list where it's like, maybe these are coming. So I think we can just go one at a time.
Vision Pro. It sounds like, I don't have links to put in the show notes handy, but it sounds like it is imminent. It probably, if I were to wager a guess, sometime this month will be at least a formal announcement as to like when it'll go on sale and whatnot. So Vision Pro could be any time now. And I'm excited for it. I'm curious to see what the response will be. I'm curious to see how one goes to buy a Vision Pro. I mean, I know there's been a lot of talk and chatter, if not official statements, that you'll have to pick it up in store. I understand that, although I have a lot of problems with it, which we can explore if we really want. But I'm very curious to see how this looks. I'm curious to see what the gray market looks like, because I know that there's a lot of people, including many of our friends that live overseas, that are very keen to have their own Vision Pro. So how does that work? You know, if you're willing to fly yourself to New York or Richmond and want to pick up a Vision Pro, is that something that Apple will sell to you? Or does it work with a non-American Apple ID? Like, how does that look? But all that being said, I'm really excited and really interested to see what this looks like once it's in the market. I'm not excited for the work I need to do to get call sheet working better on it, which I've done some of, but not enough. But I am excited overall. I don't know. Marco, how do you feel about it?
Man, I'm going to have a lot to say about it once I'm allowed to talk about experiences that I will have with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that going to a lab was amazing as a developer, not so great as a podcaster.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you're not allowed to characterize your experience, Mark.
Oh, yes.
Strike that from the record.
Yes, I went to a lab, period. But, you know, it is kind of unfortunate that, like, it's hard for me to, you know, discuss the Vision Pro and my expectations and thoughts on it because, you know, now I have some experience with it that I'm not allowed to talk about. But hopefully that will be over soon. I'm with you, Casey. I think it is probably coming within probably a month. I think it's very close. And I am excited about it. I'm trying to keep my excitement in check. You know, as I figure out, like, what am I doing for Overcast for it? You know, my initial answer was going to be, I'm just going to let the iPad app run in a window. And I have an idea for how I can make a native app for it, but looking at the market for it, I think it's going to be a very slow burn. Like, it's going to be a very slow build up because the volume is just not going to be there for a while. You know, there was those rumors from the supply chain that the little screens they're using inside, they can, that like Sony can probably only make, you know, 1 or 2 million of those screens in a year. And so there is some speculation from the supply chain, like, they might not be able to make and sell more than maybe 1 million Vision Pros in the first year. And if there's any truth to that, if you figure like approximately a year from now, maybe there's 1 million of these in active use. Well, as an app developer, how many of those 1 million people are going to have my app? If right, I'm lucky, right, maybe a few hundred. Like, it's not, it's going to be a very small number of people. And so you can't, like, from an app developer's perspective, there is going to be no good reason, I think, to port your app over to this unless you have a way to capture a huge portion of its users. I don't think, as a podcast app, I don't think I have that.
You should make an app that looks like when you tilt the glasses upward, it's like you're drinking a beer. Because that's the type of app, but like, that's what I'm thinking of with this launch of, like, you're right, there's because of the supply issues, Apple is capped in how many of these they can physically make, no matter how many people want them. And keep in mind, they're $3,500 to start, so
yeah,
it's probably not going to be them anyway. But like, you have to, there is the kind of gold rush of like, well, see, people are going to get their Vision Pro and they're like, well, I've got this thing, what kind of apps can I get for it? And if you have some general purpose app, like, it looks like we're talking about the iPhone app that showed like basically a beer on your phone and use the accelerometer when you tilted your phone, the liquid level would stay level, so like you're drinking a beer. Everyone who had an iPhone got that app because you get an iPhone and you're like, what's available for this thing? And it was like not seven things in the store, but relatively speaking, there were very few apps in the App Store. And if you were one of those apps and you were a general purpose kind of like, I'll try it, I just want to try a fun thing for my thing, you could get a massive market share of the first batch of people who bought an iPhone and make a lot of money. And that is probably going to be true on the Vision Pro, but I'm not sure a podcast player is that app. That's going to be the impulse purchase that you really want to just try out the Vision Pro. When I think Vision Pro, I don't think podcasts. So right, it's not particularly a visual medium. But someone's going to make that app. So I think there is going to be a mini gold rush to try to sell to 50% of the 1 million people who get Vision Pros. And Casey, to your point about the gray market stuff, this has got to be Apple's nightmare because Apple hates gray market stuff to begin with. And the worst thing, the thing Apple always will tell you they don't want, and they really, really don't want, which is, we don't want people to have our product and have a crappy experience because they didn't get it the Apple way. And nothing could be more problematic when it comes to that situation than a thing that fits on your face that has different size things, that, right, you know, different size light shields, yeah, and the prescription glasses and all. Like, there is no way that the gray market is going to give the buyers of those gray market things what Apple thinks the experience should be. So you're going to have developers overseas who are using uncomfortable, blurry-looking headsets because it's the only thing they could get, and they pick the prescription wrong, and they don't have the right light shield thing, and it doesn't fit their face, and it's just, it's, and Apple's going to be like, that's not how it's supposed to be. We want you to have this experience. That's why you have to wait for us to launch in your country. Come to the Apple Store. We'll scan your face. We'll make sure we find the right, you know. But it's like, well, I didn't do that. Instead, someone got it for me, and I bought it on eBay, and I just hoped that the face shield, like, wasn't too painful after 30 minutes. And that's not the experience Apple wants you to have. I mean, they hated gray market iPhones. They don't like when you use non-official Apple parts. They don't, you know, just like, this is their worst nightmare because the experience of Vision Pro can be so much worse. Like, the floor is so low if you get one that doesn't fit right, you know, and doesn't look right with the, you know, prescription lenses. And so many people need prescriptions. Like, I still think about this, not that I'm planning on getting one, but it's like, when I heard Casey, when I heard you talking, when you're on the talk show, talking about like the prescription lenses and stuff, setting aside the price, I was like, what prescription would I tell Apple? Because Gruber's like, oh, I came to the thing and they just asked what my prescription was. Because I have two sets of glasses now. I haven't moved to bifocals or progressives.
Right.
But I have my computer glasses that I'm wearing now to look at my screen. And then I have my TV watching glasses that are my driving glasses that are my distance glasses. I don't know which prescription I should give them. What distance? Because my computer glasses are made to be comfortable for me looking at my screen that's like an arm's length, right? And my driving glasses are basically 20/20 at infinity, you know, like it's for distance stuff. What prescription would I even give Apple? And believe me, I'm not the only old person with two different prescriptions for up close and far away. There are a lot of us. And so that's got to be part of the experience. It's not like you're going to go into the Apple Store and they're going to say, oh, what's your prescription? Because that's not an easy question. You have to say, what's your prescription when viewing things from X distance? And I don't even know what that distance is. Is it the distance that they typically hang windows by default in front of you? Is it the distance
well,
the screens
yes.
are?
I mean, remember we talked about that whole like convergence effect thing earlier in the fall.
Yeah.
And it does seem like they are optimizing for the equivalent distance of whatever it is, like a few meters in front of you, like wherever the default spot is. They put windows and kind of like on this
meters.
Axis around you. Well, we have a
how far is
podcast.
That in feet?
yeah, it's something like 8 or 10 feet in front of you, I think.
All this is to say that getting the experience Apple wants you to have from their Vision Pro is going to be trickier than any other Apple product, even more so than the watch. And gray market is just going to exacerbate that. And that's just part of being an early adopter, and people will suffer through it. But boy, it's got to really eat Apple up because they spent so long trying to make this product and get the right set of face shields, and they know how it should work, like internally or whatever, just to know that like 20% of basically everyone outside the U.S. who has this thing is having a substandard experience. You know, what can you do?
Yeah, that's tough. But, you know, I think the Vision Pro is going to be the story of the first few months of the year, at least. I am a little bit I'm a little concerned for Apple that the press and like the hype won't stick as much as they want it to, because it's going to be such a slow buildup of a market, I think. And I you know, they have put so much into this product, like in terms of, you know, their time and resources and everything. But when was the last time Apple launched a really high profile brand new product that was not expected to be a massive volume hit?
iPhone.
Yeah, that's it. And that was a long time ago, and that was a very different company. And, you know, now, like, you know, you can say something like, oh, the Mac Pro, but that's not nearly the resources that went into the Vision Pro.
They haven't launched anything that they're fully behind as, like, this is a new paradigm. Like, the watch was the closest you could say. It's like, this is a new way of computing or whatever. But, I think this is fine for Apple, because I think they'll weather it fine, because it's almost kind of a relief to essentially be supply constrained in the first year, give them time to get their feet under them, kind of like with the watch. Like, Apple has an idea of what they think this thing will be good for, but what does the market think? And so this will be a big story in early 2024, and I think it will settle down and people will forget about it and move on, and that will give the product time to grow into itself, right? And because, you know, either they all sell out, or the story is Apple couldn't even sell a million of them and it's too expensive, blah, blah, blah. Like, that will give,
with that
because Apple's
too.
Not going to be, Apple's not going to be scared by that. Apple's not going to go, oh my God, forget it. We did so badly. We're just going to cancel this product. No, they're going to ride out 2024. No matter what happens, they're going to learn from what's out there in the market, and 2025, they'll regroup and, you know, continue on. So I'm not worried about all the inevitable stories and the low sales due to either supply constraints or lack of demand or whatever. And even if it's best case and we're like, they sell out instantly and people are spending huge amounts of money for them on in the gray market and everybody wants them and it's just so exciting, but they can't make them, and they make the stories like, oh, Apple should have, you know, found another supplier for those screens or whatever. Even if the very best happens in that scenario, it's still going to be like just a rookie year for the Vision Pro. Don't expect it to take over the world. Even the iPhone didn't take over the world in its first year of sales. It was a curiosity. It was a thing that people who could tolerate AT&T used, and it was like, I'm not so sure about this. Like, and the iPhone is like, you know, the best-selling consumer product ever. So do not expect the Vision Pro to do better than the iPhone in its first year. And if it does 10 times worse, don't worry about it. I feel like Apple is pretty dedicated to this. Even if it 100% flops, I think they're going to keep plugging away at this.
Well, and I think we're going, like, I don't think Apple's going to have any trouble selling as many as they can make this year. Like, they're going to sell every single one they
can
make.
Because they can't make that many.
Right. It's going to be backordered. It's going to be hard to get. Like, it's going to be, they're going to sell them all. That's not going to be the problem. But what I am envisioning is that people are going to buy it with a set of expectations about what they're going to be able to use it for. And then that will change, because that's what happens with new tech categories. It happened with the Apple Watch. It happened before that.
Remember,
the
iPhone didn't have an app store when it launched.
Right.
So talk about changing the way people use the device. The people who had the first iPhone are using it differently than we are, because there was no app store.
Right. And this is going to go through the same kind of hype curve of, like, you know, you're going to have, you know, now before it's actually out, but after it's been announced, You have people saying, oh my God, this is, you know, we're going to have to rethink cities. Like, I'll be able to get all my work done in this headset. I'll never have to buy a computer or a monitor again. And you're going to have those people go out and buy it. It's not going to fulfill that expectation for some percentage of those people. The expectations are going to crash, saying, I tried living my entire life in a Vision Pro for a month, and this is
and
what
my
happened.
Face is all sweaty and my right. nose hurts.
Right. So then the expectations are going to crash. You're going to have people like Federico who, like, actually will figure out how to get all their work done in it, and it's going to be, you know, a whole bunch of complex hacks to make it work for you. And then, you know, and you're going to have people say, actually, I traveled only with this device for this trip, and here's how I did it. So there's going to be this, you know, this big, you know, roller coaster of press for it from people who are, like, you know, kicking the tires, trying it out, you know, tech enthusiasts, people who are trying to, like, live in it and do, you know, way too much stuff in it. Then you're going to have all the people saying, I tried this and it was bad for reason X, and then all that's going to crash. And then your people are going to try it again and try different things, and some new app will come out for it that'll make it better. And it's going to be that kind of roller coaster for a while. It's going to be a fun year in the sense that, like, that kind of experimentation I always find really fun and entertaining for both myself to try to do it, but mostly to listen and watch to what other people are doing with it and kind of experience it vicariously through other people who have more time than I do. But at the end of that roller coaster, I think this product is going to be really great for the market that it finds. But that's not going to be a big market for a while for lots of reasons. Price, supply, apps, like, it's going to be – there's lots of reasons why it's not going to be a huge market yet. And I hope that everyone, including Apple, is able to keep perspective that when it comes out and does not set the whole world on fire, that's not necessarily a failure. It's just the early part of its lifetime and the earliest part of this market. But ultimately, I'm very excited for that market, and I think there's a lot of good uses for it. But it's going to be a slow start.
Marco, do you plan on buying one?
Of course, immediately. Like, because here's the thing: like, as a developer of these platforms, like, my app will be there, whether, like, people will use it. Now, you know, like, I was looking earlier today, like, by simply having the checkbox that allows people with M series Macs to run my iPad app on their Mac, all I ever did was check that checkbox or leave that checkbox checked. It's checked by default in the App Store. I allow people to run my iPad app on Apple Silicon Macs. That has now accumulated a very large number of Mac users. I have more Mac users than I have iPad users, that's not what I would have guessed, but that's the reality. So I expect that I am going to allow my iPad app to run unless there's some massive show-stopping bug, but I am not allowed to tell you whether there is or not. But I plan to allow my app to run as long as it doesn't have major problems. And that, you know, I will see what kind of usage it gets. And I will make decisions from there about, like, when and whether to make a native version. But I have some ideas for a native version I think are good. I'm going to want to try them. I'm going to want to try them immediately because, you know, even though my likely market of Vision Pro owners in the first year is probably going to be, like, you know, fewer people than use, like, the large widget. Like, it's going to be like some, you know, slice of a slice of a slice. It numbers wise relative to my entire product and my entire audience for my app, it's going to be nothing. But it's important for me to be there for other reasons. You know, there's value in the people who are, like, the influencers and the press. There's value in them seeing my app there and using it and knowing it's there. There's a certain level of demand there that I want to address from that kind of person. There's value to Apple and therefore value to me indirectly through, you know, favor with Apple. So there's all sorts of reasons why I would probably want to be there anyway. Numbers are not one of them. And I expect the Vision Pro and the Overcast app for it to be a massively money-losing operation for me for a while. But I absolutely will be buying one the second I can get my hands on one. And I think a large portion of the early buyers will be developers and companies that are buying it to test their stuff on and to develop for. But we'll see. I mean, that being said, like, a lot of small developers are super uninterested in paying $3,500 for this.
Hi.
Right. Like, I think there's, it's not as much of a slam dunk for every developer out there to buy this as, say, like the first iPad was, because we had different expectations and it was way cheaper. This is very expensive, and anyone who's like running the numbers is like, well, how much money am I going to make with my software on Vision Pro? And is that going to help pay for the $3,500? No. No, it will not. Not for a while, at least. But so that's going to impact the market to some degree. It's not going to be purchased by every iOS developer out there. Like, that's not going to happen for lots of reasons. But they will be bought by some developers. It's and some, you know, YouTubers and influencers and just, you know, people who want to try it. Business travelers, rich people. Like, it's going to, there is a market for it, and it's going to be really fun and amazing. But it's not going to be the next iPad or Apple Watch for a while, if ever.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do, because I don't know that I have an overabundance of interest from a user's perspective, but I do feel I feel some amount of responsibility as the developer of CallSheet. I feel a fairly considerable amount of responsibility as one of the three hosts of this program. And since John doesn't want to take the fall, and it's always up to you and me to take care of this, then
I bought this Mac Pro. You've got a lot of spending to do.
I mean, only a few Vision Pros, though.
Yeah, right. Well, then again, he did option that Mac Pro. So we're looking at, like, I don't know, 10 Vision Pros. How much did you spend on that damn thing? It doesn't matter.
Three or four?
But anyway, it's certainly more, it covers both of your Vision Pros. So go ahead.
Oh, I see.
Plus, anyway, you both have apps that legitimately could be on the platform. It's not like you're just doing it for the show.
Honestly, CallSheet, it probably has a much bigger audience on Vision Pro than Overcast does.
Well,
exactly.
I mean,
you're watching a movie, you look to your left, and you say some voice thing that says, who is that? And then your app captures the video. No, forget it. You can't do that. Anyway.
No, you can't do any of that. And actually,
do that.
I think it was during the talk show that Gruber and I were talking this out.
Yeah,
and it occurred to me that I don't think CallSheet can run side by side with a video player, because the best of my understanding, a video player is an immersive experience. You know, there's three different experiences. There's the windows, I forget what they call them,
like spaces, volumes.
Spaces, yeah, that's
but,
it. Thank
but,
you.
But I will remind you what the early versions of iOS and WatchOS and iPadOS look like, and what their limitations were and how long those lasted. So
that's fair.
Yeah. Don't worry too much about it. I feel, yes, I know that the limitations that they have now, but this is like the 1.0-iest of 1.0s, and inevitably, once this product comes in contact with developers and apps and users, that is all going to change so fast. It even changed on the iPad eventually. So I have much faith that applications like yours will eventually be able to do same things. But I do agree with you that right now, there's probably a bunch of annoying limitations that make it difficult for you to do what you want. And then you should give that feedback to Apple, and they'll incorporate that into the next version of the OS.
Well, yeah, honestly, I think, first of all, you'll be in the clear. Second of all, if you're not, app switching exists and people figure it out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, I think you're fine either way. But you know, I think this is probably going to be a device that gets a lot of like movie and TV watching done on it. So the market for CallSheet is I think much more direct than the market for people who want an audio only podcast player.
Well, they could be listening to the podcast while they're working on their spreadsheets and their Vision Pro headset.
They can. I mean, and that's why people use the Mac app. You know, it's hard for me to understand the needs of that market, because I'm not a listen to podcasts while working kind of person. So I don't ever use Overcast on my Mac. But I use it constantly on my phone, because I'm like, when I'm out and around doing stuff and walking the dog and washing dishes, like, that's when I listen to podcasts. But I don't understand how people listen to podcasts while working, because my brain doesn't work that way. So I don't know how people are going to use it necessarily in Vision Pro, but it's not like I can envision a situation where you might want an experience in Vision Pro where you're like transported to some place, like you want to like hang out on top of a mountain somewhere, and maybe just put a podcast on and listen to it. I can envision that being a market. Again, I don't know how big of a market. Maybe a few hundred people in the first year. Like, it's not going to be a big market, but I can envision use cases like that. The Vision Pro is a very broad product. It can do a lot of things, and we don't really know yet what is going to be its most popular uses, but I can hazard a guess that it's going to be very consumption focused, I think, in practice. It's very, very much like the iPad, where I think there will be people who will do productivity work on it, but I don't think that's going to be the most common case. I think it is much more likely that people will use it more for media consumption and like immersive experience consumption than doing your spreadsheets and email. Like I think, again, you will be able to do your spreadsheets and email in it. I don't see that being a huge part of its use case. But so then, like, are people going to listen to audio podcasts? I mean, while they watch videos, probably not. But while they sit on a mountaintop, maybe. So again, like, this all remains to be seen. But I think it is a very clear-cut case for call sheet, because there's going to be, I think, a lot of video watching in this device.
Yeah, we'll see. But I am not looking forward to spending $3,500 plus on something that its use as a person to me, I'm not entirely convinced yet. But again,
you're going to have one on day one.
I think I'm gonna. I've convinced myself I probably need to.
You're gonna buy it, and you're gonna grumble about the price, and you're gonna love it.
No, okay. So I am gonna buy it.
Oh, grumble, but this is so cool.
I'm going to buy it. I'm going to grumble about the price. I think I'll say it's extremely cool. The question is, will I pick it up after, you know, completing whatever I need to do with call sheet? I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll love it. I don't know. But we'll see. I wish I could talk about what happened at the labs. Anyway,
I know, me too. I'm dying here.
It's killing me. All right, John, tell us about OLED iPads. What do we think is happening there?
This is, we just both talked about Vision Pro, but OLED iPads are the product that I'm most excited about for 2024 from Apple, believe it or not, because I'm for sure going to buy these if they are OLED iPads, because I use my iPad to watch video all the time, and an OLED iPad would do a better job of showing video because it would have better black levels. I want this so bad. It hasn't been that long since I got my iPad. I have an M1 iPad. It's not that old, but the OLED screen is a reason enough for me to upgrade. For the wider market, as we've discussed in the past, we hope that they'll rationalize the iPad line, update the Pros to have the landscape camera, figure out what they're going to do with the Pencil. After taking the year off, essentially, 2023, the iPad took that whole year off. All we got was the weird Pencil. 2024 is the year of actually releasing iPads, some of which we hope are good. And the only reason I highlight this as item number two is because this is the one I'm definitely going to buy. You two are going to try to get Vision Pros if you possibly can, if they don't sell out in the first 30 seconds. I am absolutely buying an iPad, and I think I'll have an easier time getting one. And it will be cheaper.
Yeah, well, it's hard to be more expensive than...
Well, if you got the 8-terabyte model, maybe it would be the same price, but yeah. We'll see.
And by the way, Vision Pro, starting at $3,500. We don't know the details of that statement yet. All they said was starting at $3,500.
Each individual prescription lens is $1,500. These are Porsche option prices.
I know you're joking, but it wouldn't surprise me if they are hilariously expensive.
Yeah, blue stitching, an extra $400. Yeah,
just hope that you can't adjust the storage at all.
Yeah. Well, but like, what is the storage going to be used for? How many people buying it will even know yet? Like, I don't know how much storage I need on my Vision Pro. I have no idea. Like, so we'll see.
Better get the big one, I guess.
Well, or like, do you want to invest that much extra money in like version 1.0 that's going to be obsolete?
I get the big Apple TV. It's a little bit less expensive, but
yeah, it's like, what is it, $50, $30?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, but so the iPad, I think is going to be, I've kind of fallen out of using the iPad for almost anything, but I go in phases. I go up and down. I'm sure when they launch them, I'm going to be like, oh, I want that because it's new and shiny and OLED, and I'll rationalize myself buying one.
Especially if it's
reason.
Dual-layer OLED screen that some of the rumors are interested. Super bright, really amazing quality. It would essentially be the best quality screen available on an Apple product because it will surpass the LCD, mini LED things on the MacBook Pros, and certainly surpass the XDR.
Yeah, that would be great. But yeah, like I'm mostly just curious to see what they do with the iPad Pro, especially because the iPad Pro has not seen a meaningful update redesign since 2018. It is pretty long in the tooth now. I really want to know, like, do they address things like the Pencil attachment mechanism, any kind of Pencil charging changes, because like there's rumors that there's going to be like a new Pro Pencil as well. What do they do about where the camera is? Like, one of the biggest annoyances of using the iPad Pro for me is that the camera's still on the short side, and I almost 100% using it in the little keyboard flappy thing. Not the Magic Trackpad equipped one, the one before that, the straight one that Craig Federighi uses. So I use that one, and so the camera is always right under my left hand. Like, as when you pick up the iPad, it is directly under where you pick
it
up.
And it warns you about it, which is when you have to add a software feature to compensate for a hardware thing, that's when you know the hardware thing is outlived its useful life.
Yeah, and they did update one of the lower-end iPads to have the camera like on the long edge, like a laptop. So if you're holding it in landscape, it's in the top middle. That, I think, is the clear answer for where it should be on the iPad Pro and on probably on all iPads as well. But it interferes with where the pencil attaches right now in the current iPad Pro. So that this is a question, like, where do you put the pencil? If you put it on the short side, that has other downsides. You can still put it on the long side, but like change where the magnets are so you can fit the camera between them or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
that's
options.
What everyone assumes they're going to do. That's like the whole reason for the new pencil. I'm sure the pencil will have new features, but the main reason is, oh, we have to rejigger the internals to make room for the camera that's on the long side, and that'll be the Apple Pencil 3 or whatever. So, and I just want to say that if they come out with a new iPad and it has an OLED screen and they change nothing else about it, I'm still getting it because I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm going to wait until they have the landscape camera. That's not what I'm using the iPad for. I do have a pencil, and I do use it, and it is annoying that my hand covers the FaceTime camera and everything like that. But still, no matter what they do, if it is just if they do like the, you know, the new Mac Pro that launched this very podcast, it's exactly the same iPad as we have now. But the only difference is a new OLED screen. I'm still getting it.
I mean, that would still be a huge upgrade. But
it would be incredibly disappointing to everybody but me.
Yeah, but I do hope there's more. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, 2023, there were literally no new iPads released, and the state of the iPad lineup, as we've discussed previously, is really messy right now because it seems like they're like halfway through multiple different important transitions, things like moving the camera, unifying the pencils, like stuff like this. Like there's a lot of like half done transitions in the iPad lineup. There's way too many iPads. The differentiation between them is odd and confusing. There's lots of like, you know, little nitpicks of like, well, you can use this keyboard with this one, but not with this very similar one. They have three different iPads that are all like within a half inch screen size of each other. Like it's a weird lineup. What I expect and hope from 2024 for the iPad is for us to finally get the answer of like, where is the iPad going, and give us a coherent lineup that puts us there. That I really hope for, and I think is likely to actually happen. I'm sure they're going to do the thing where they keep around an old model of the cheap one, but they're already still doing that. Like, so they currently have two, you know, base models, basically, like the more modern designed one and the one that still has the home button and the forehead and chin. And so hopefully they're able to get rid of the home button one finally, move the more modern one down to that slot, and then give us the new base model, you know. So there's a lot to do in the iPad lineup. It seems like they're slated to do all of it this year, basically, because I think every iPad approximately is due for an update. So we will see. I hope they do it. I hope they do a good job. And I hope whatever changes are coming to the iPad Pro were worth the wait from 2018.
Fair enough. All right. M3 Ultra, maybe in the Mac Studio. Perhaps in a new Mac Pro. What do we think about that?
I mean, I guess really this could have been inverted, but it shows where my interest lies. You know, the Mac Studio and Mac Pro are due to be updated this year. They will presumably get the M3 Ultra, which is a chip that we assume will exist, and it will just be two M3 Maxes stuck together in the usual way. But the thing is, the M3 Max is amazing, and two of them will be twice as amazing. So that will be a really good chip. And despite the fact that the Mac Studio will surely come with the M3 Max, it will also come with the M3 Ultra, and that's going to really differentiate it from the rest of the product line. I don't expect any other changes to these products other than them just existing and getting the new chip. And for the Mac Studio, I think that's fine. And for the Mac Pro, it is exactly as disappointing as last year's Mac Pro. No change there. In particular, the M3 Ultra Mac Studio, I feel like, is becoming increasingly essential for Apple's supposed ambitions in gaming. They have a long way to go there, but it is nice to be able to have something that they sell that has more GPU grunt than a laptop, right? And the Mac Studio is going to have twice as much GPU grunt as their fastest laptop because it'll have two M3 Maxes in there with twice the GPU grunt. Does that make a difference for the tiny amount of games that exist? No, probably not, but it's, you know, at the very least, again, we'll see how it performs in the benchmarks, but something better than a laptop is kind of one of those like really low bar that Apple needs to clear to start taking itself seriously as a gaming company. And we've discussed this many times in the past. It's great that they've, you know, raised the floor, that none of their computers stink anymore. They're all pretty good. But you got to have at least one really good one, one pretty okay one. You know what I mean? And that is the role of the M3 Ultra. It's not the Mac Pro. No one's buying that thing for games. But the Mac Studio is small, cheaper than the Mac Pro. And, you know, it should be, you know, close to twice as fast when running game stuff, because it's got twice the GPU. So I'm looking forward. I'm not planning on buying that. I'm still, you know, the clock on my 2019 Mac Pro is mostly dictated by Apple. I was thinking over the holiday that, like, how long would I be willing to keep using this Mac Pro after Apple stops supporting it with the latest version of Mac OS? And I think that is a non-zero amount of time for me, because I do want to wait to buy at the right time. You know what I mean? I'm impressed by the M3 series, especially the M3 Max. The M3 Max is often benchmarking it higher than the M2 Ultra in certain tests, right? So I feel like they're pressing on the high end, right? I want to see what an M4 or an M5 looks like if I can hold out that long. So that's all. I look forward to these computers existing, and I look forward to seeing the benchmarks, and I am, you know, I'm ready to continue to be disappointed by the Mac Pro.
So what is the current plan as of the beginning of 2024 when Apple says no more new macOS releases for Intel? Do you immediately buy a Apple Silicon Mac Pro? Do you
No, like I said, I'm willing to be in, you know, it's stuck in amber of like, okay, there, it's not supported anymore. I'm just going to keep using it after the version is released that I can't run anymore. How long will I last in that state? I don't know. If you'd asked me before, I'd say, well, as soon as that happens, I'm going to buy one, so I'm never going to be in that state. But now I'm thinking that I'm willing to be on the previous year's OS that Marco can never remember the name of for a non-zero amount of time. Is that going to be 6 months? Is that going to be a year? Like, it's kind of be like me in buying TVs. Like, I want to pick the right time to buy. I would like to wait to see them do something more than the current Ultra strategy with their top end chip. You know what I mean? Even if I buy it in a Mac Studio, I would love to see, as we discussed in the past, a different packaging arrangement, or, you know, something different than we seem to do with M1 through M3 with respect to the Ultra, right? If I can hold out that long, I will. If I can't, then I'll just get an M4 Ultra Mac Studio. Like, that's my plan, essentially. Like, so whatever that, if when the time comes when I just can't hold that any longer and it's just untenable, and I, you know, maybe I need to update it to do dev work on my apps, whatever the situation is, when I get pressed to do it, if assuming there's still the Mac Pro is still like it is, I'm going to end up getting a Mac Studio with whatever the best Ultra is.
Well, I know we're going off on a tangent. It's my fault. But what do you feel like your Mac Pro is uniquely good at that the Studio isn't? I know the obvious answer is gaming now, but that won't be that's not likely to be the case in any future Mac Pro. So, like, you don't have 340 hard drives in there, do you?
I mean, I do have a bunch. I have all my storage is internal. Well, except for my Windows drive, which is external, but I do like my, I have
but
an
why
internal,
is that external if everything else is internal?
I have an internal Time Machine drive, an internal super duper clone, and then I have the regular boot disk, and I have swapped video cards many times. And I know what you're saying, like, well, you're not going to be able to run PC games because it's not x86, yada, yada. But I do want to buy something with GPU grunt that essentially is going to be sitting there idle in the hopes that Apple's gaming strategy bears fruit. Or at the worst case, that I can boot into Linux and play like Steam games that are for the Steam Deck. You know what I mean? Like,
what?
I want the GPU grunt to be there speculatively. Like, I don't, it is not a sure thing as, hey, I can boot this thing into Windows and play Windows games. That is a sure thing, right? That's easy to know. Why do I want a Mac with more GPU grunt? That's speculative. That's me crossing my fingers and saying, boy, I hope I can do something gaming related with this extra GPU grunt. And, you know, maybe I'll get burned. Maybe it'll turns out that for the millionth time, Apple's gaming strategy won't work out, and I can't run Windows, and I can't run Linux games with Proton and stuff. But that's the plan.
Why won't you put your Windows boot drive in the machine? You feel like it's tainting it, don't you?
I mean, that's mostly because, like, the Windows boot drive, yeah, it probably should be inside the machine, but the tainting is not the reason I did it, but it's kind of, it goes on one of my crappier SSDs because, you know, it doesn't really matter. And I think it's changed a few times. And it was such a pain to get it working on the external one that was kind of like a sunk cost fallacy. But anyway, yeah, I think this thing is probably in its final arrangement of components after many, many swaps and stuff where it's all solid state. It's got that one external. Oh, you know what I mean? When I did the Sonoma drive, that was also external because that's like a throwaway one that I'm constantly erasing and stuff. And I use it on different computers. So, yeah.
Fair enough. All right, iPhone 16. I don't know too much of what to expect from this. Obviously, we've talked about the, what do they call it?
Capture button.
I wanted to say action. I was like, that's not right. The capture button, which I think could be very interesting, and I'm optimistic about that. I'm slightly terrified about dropping the 5X tetraprism thing into the regular size phones, because I don't know which one I would buy then, because I both like
it.
I don't know.
You would come back to the medium side.
Yeah, I think I would. Especially since the rumor is that the 16 is going to be a little bit bigger than
that's
the 15.
True. That's
again,
a good point.
They're doing it again.
Yep.
Yeah. I think the thing that they're doing. Remember that the 15 shrunk because they shrunk the bezels all around it and everything.
Yeah.
I think they're essentially not undoing that, but making the screen bigger by an old bezels width. Right? Just to give themselves more room internally for the tetraprism camera and a bunch of other stuff. And honestly, I'm fine with that because I'm using a 14 Pro now, and the 14 Pro is bigger than the 15 Pro. So like 15 Pro shrunk a little bit. It sounds like the 16 is going to be the same size as my current phone. And keep in mind that I am buying the 16 because that's my phone year. So from my perspective, the 16 will be the same size as my current phone. But from your perspective, it'll be a little bit bigger than your 15 Pro. And from Casey's perspective, it'll be way smaller than that stupid pop socket thing you've got.
That's true. No, I mean, there are some things I like about this phone, but I do miss having a phone that you can legitimately, without worry, without a dongle on the back or, you know, a wart on the back, use one-handed. You know, I don't have gigantor hands like, you know, Mike Hurley does. And so I really do need some sort of affordance on there. And so I am cautiously and tentatively optimistic that maybe I would be able to go back to the, you know, human sized phone again, which I think would be kind of nice. I'll miss the real estate, you know, and I'll miss maybe the battery life, although that hasn't been as night and day as I had expected, but it would be nice to have a phone I could use one handed again. So I don't know, Marco, what are your thoughts on the iPhone 16?
I mean, we don't know a ton about it yet, but, you know, if the rumors are true that it's going to be, you know, adding a capture button and giving me the 5X lens, that's great. I am looking forward to that because the 5X lens I am super envious of. Whenever I have a moment to see TIFFs or to use it, I'm always like, man, I wish I had this on my phone. But I don't wish enough to get the giant phone. So, again,
that's fair.
hopefully I get that. And otherwise, I don't really know. This is what happens every year. I'm very happy with the iPhone I have now. But, you know, I'm sure they'll find a way to make me want to buy the new one.
This will have the realigned cameras on both of them, by the way, on both the 16 and the 16 Pro, like the realigned cameras for spatial video, because they'll both be able to do it. And the rumor is also that they'll both have the capture button, and like it won't be a Pro-only feature. So, and there are some, I mean, we talked about this a million times when we were talking about the SoCs, like what are they going to do? Is there going to be A18 Pro and an A18? Are they going to be unified? Are they going to be split? Is there going to be one that's like last year's model, but with GPU things? We don't know what they're going to do with the SoCs, but it seems like from the physical feature sets, they're both going to have the aligned cameras and they're both going to have the capture button. I still, at this early stage, I still feel like the capture button is kind of like the solid state volume buttons, and it's the type of thing that we could be hearing plans from back in time, and really that decision was reversed and we won't know about it until the next round of rumors comes out, you know what I mean? And maybe there just won't be a capture button and we'll wait till next year. But from what I've heard, it sounds like the 16 line will be more unified and coherent than the 15 one was. But we'll see. It's a long ways off. But, you know, the iPhone is, especially with no rumors about anything radical, it's just like, oh, it's a year where they're consolidating gains from the previous phones. And, you know, it's not every year the iPhone is good. I don't think there's any chance of it being terrible, but I don't think there's much chance either of it being something like an iPhone 10 type revelation.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, and I'm glad you brought up the spatial video thing, John, because that, I think, would be a huge motivator. If it can take spatial video better than 1080p 30, which is very restrictive.
Yeah, that might be a differentiator on the Pro. Like, they'll both have the aligned cameras for spatial video, and the rumor is that the ultra-wide that is aligned with it is going to be 48 megapixel, and maybe only on the Pro you'll get, you know, better frame rates, better resolution, whatever.
Yeah, and look, Apple, I know this decision's already been made, you know, 15 years ago, but if you have to raise either the frame rate or the resolution, and you can't do both. Give me the frame rate, please. Like 30 FPS.
I think with the Vision Pro, I think the resolution may have more bang for the buck because it's so big in your field of vision. You know what I mean?
I'm not allowed to tell you whether I know what you mean.
Okay. Anyway, yes. I mean, Casey and Gruber discussed it with like, it's not as big as Panoramas. Panoramas is where it suffers the most, according to Gruber, but the spatial video is apparently smaller, but still, it's pretty big.
Tell you any of that. However, I can tell you I really want more resolution out of my cameras now.
More frame rate, you mean?
Both. I would suggest for panoramas, you would probably want a lot of resolution as well. But I definitely, I mean, like one of the things that I am really looking forward to in the Vision Pro, Merlin introduced me to this Polycam app. Where it basically it's one of these apps that uses like the LiDAR and the cameras and everything, and you can make like a 3D, you can 3D capture and make a floor plan or a whole like 3D map of a room.
As long as your room is not filled with junk, I know from experience. Right.
Yeah, but you know, but like that's a really cool thing. I'm looking forward to just like I don't know if you can even do this yet on Vision Pro, but I'm sure it will come fairly soon if you can't. Like whatever standard, you know, USDZ scene formats that these kind of things can output, I want to be able to capture a place with my iPhone using something like Polycam and then be able to like be in it in the Vision Pro at a later time. Like, oh, what was it like to be, you know, in my room in this one apartment that I captured, you know, and then I don't live there anymore. Like, you know, that kind of thing. Like that would be so cool to me. What, you know, what was it like on this vacation? What was our hotel room like? You know, what was my kid's room like when he was this age? I would love to be able to capture that kind of stuff and then kind of just experience it in the Vision Pro. And I think one thing that you will probably want, if we see that, is the most resolution possible on those captures. Because what you are seeing in the Vision Pro, the field of view it is simulating is massive compared to a phone or a computer screen. So the pictures that we take today on our you know little iPhone camera sensors or whatever, you know, a single picture, yeah, that looks great on your phone. If you're lucky, it might look okay on your laptop screen, but when you put it onto like a 50-foot tall virtual screen or something, that's a different experience.
That's also when people complain that I'm nitpicking when I say, well, iPhone photos are fine unless you're quote-unquote pixel peeping. Well, guess what? Everyone inside of Vision Pro is pixel peeping. Because everything is so much bigger. So it could be the side of a billboard. And suddenly you see, I mean, we talked about last time with the picture of you towing your car on the beach and what a mess it made of your face because it was low light.
Yeah.
You're not going to need the pixel peep to see that when it's 50 feet tall in front of you.
Yeah, but like, so I think the rise of these, you know, headsets, whether it's the Vision Pro or the Quest series or whatever, like the rise of these headsets, I think is going to increase the demand for much higher resolution phone cameras, basically, that can actually capture a lot more detail of our surroundings and our experiences that we go through in life. And you know, and maybe even, you know, big cameras might have a small resurgence because they're so much higher resolution. But I think ultimately, like, it has to go on the phones. Like, this has to be and maybe they'll just do it with a bunch of, you know, combination capture. Like, okay, we'll
yeah,
take this.
That's what big cameras do. That speaking of big cameras,
they can,
cameras
yeah.
with huge sensors, with huge like big mirrorless cameras with like 60 megapixel sensors, also have a mode where they will take 75 pictures and stitch them together for massive resolution. And the phones should. I mean, that's what panorama is. It's taking a bunch of captures and stitching them together. That kind of technology, like you can't just keep adding megapixels. It's not going to work, especially with a phone. But what you can do is get more and more intelligent modes of taking a whole bunch of 48 megapixel captures and weaving them together into something that looks better and better inside Vision Pro.
Yeah, and you know, talking about like, you know, as the Vision Pro market very slowly grows over time, that will give the iPhone a chance to have its cameras grow too. Because if the Vision Pro takes off. And if it sticks around for the long haul and becomes something that a lot of us really want and enjoy, again, you're going to want the highest resolution captures possible. And current phone stuff, again, looks great on the phone, but when you blow it up, like, it doesn't. Most phone pictures don't even look that good on my Pro Display XDR, and that is, you know, in the scale of what the Vision Pro is giving us, the XDR is like a relatively tiny app window for the Vision Pro. So, you know, it's a very different scale that we're talking about of experiencing our media, and there's going to be just demand for infinitely higher resolution.
That's why as a consumption device is another thing in its favor, because in the beginning, you know, professional companies that can take very expensive, huge cameras and actually capture massive resolution, that's the only content that's going to be available that can truly take advantage of the, you know, the Vision Pro with all the resolution that's available as you turn your head around. And regular people won't be able to make that, certainly not with their iPhones. And most people aren't going to buy like the weird 360 camera rigs that stitch together these high megapixel images. But some companies will be able to, like Apple and other companies who can essentially ship an app that is the equivalent of the single app ebook. Remember those days right? It's just like, what is this? It's an app that just shows you a bunch of places, but we capture them with our camera equipment that costs as much as your house.
Yeah, it's and 60 you're gigs.
You can't capture this, but we captured it and it looks amazing. And you're just going to want to sit here and listen to podcasts on Marco's app.
Maybe I should do that. Maybe that's my app. Maybe it's like I create an immersive experience that I film some mountain somewhere with some crazy camera.
It gives you an excuse to buy another $200,000 worth of 3D video capture equipment and then go on top of a mountain.
I definitely have not recently purchased a very high resolution camera. Definitely not.
Oh, gosh. All right. After show. Apple Watch 10. I'm excited to see. I got to imagine they're going to make this look different. And I'm excited to see what that looks like.
I mean, some people keep saying with the Roman numeral X10, right? That it's like, oh, it'll be like the iPhone 10 or Mac OS 10. It'll be the time they change the form factor. But what if they're not ready to change the form factor? Then it's just going to be Apple Watch 10 with a 1 and a 0. And we'll worry about it next year. Like, this would be a convenient time, but sometimes convenient times don't always line up. I hope it is a new form factor. It is a reasonable time for it to be one, but there's no like pressing need, like they have to do it or whatever. And if it doesn't line up, it doesn't line up. Hey, look what they did with the iPhone. They were ready early, and so they just skipped 9. It's fine.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess that's true, but I just have a gut feeling that it's going to happen.
It'll be cool if they use the X too.
Yeah, totally. And I'm honestly like I'm a little scared. Because the Apple Watch is what I wear most days, and I'm a huge, watch snob, and I'm currently, like, I'm happy with the Apple Watch. I don't super love it. I don't super hate anything about it. We're in a nice, stable place. And I'm a little worried if they're going to, like, take some big moves. I'm a little worried they might, mess some stuff up. Like, I gotta say, I still don't love watchOS 10, but that's a story for another day, I guess. So, we'll see what they do with the hardware. So I'm a little nervous, but their track record with the Apple Watch hardware is really good. With the exception of, the first one just being so darn slow and everything, but that wasn't really their fault. The recent generations of the Apple Watch hardware have really just been amazing. It's been a little boring, but it's, with the exception of the Ultra, which was a huge hit. The regular series Apple Watch, it doesn't change much in recent years, but every year brings some kind of like little incremental changes that over time add up. And so the recent Apple Watches are great. But as I said last time this came up, like I would like to see some refreshing and variety happen in the Apple Watch lineup just because it is still jewelry. Some updates and refreshing over time are a nice thing to have. So I'm looking forward to that. The whole strap attachment rumor things has me a little nervous. Yeah. But again, you look at Apple's track record on making straps, they're amazing. Like, Apple has the best watch straps in the watch industry by a huge margin, generally speaking. Like, yeah, one or two nice ones from other vendors exist, but, like, Apple watch straps on the whole, and I'm really mostly or only talking about the ones by Apple, not by third parties, which are largely garbage, but Apple's own Apple watch straps not only are amazing today, but have been amazing for the entire run of the Apple Watch. Like, even the very first ones they launched with the very first Apple Watch, those straps were all amazing. Like, they were super good straps. So they're really good at this. And if they're going to redo the strap mechanism, I trust that they're probably going to come out with some really nice straps to go with it, too. So I'm looking forward to this rumor of this, big Apple Watch revamp. I think it's time, and I trust that they will probably do a really good job with it.
All right.
The strap rumor is the one that I'm most willing to believe. I couldn't get that one done. Like, I'm, you know, if I had to rank them, like, new shape redesign for 10 is higher ranked for me than new shape and also new strap, because, you know, that's our previous discussion. Maybe they couldn't figure out something better, and so it goes in the back burner for a few more years or whatever. But having them both would be great. That would really be an Apple Watch 10. New design, new strap, new everything. It would be very much like the iPhone 10.
Well, but the thing is, like, you know, according to the rumor that, like, one of the reasons they were looking at a new strap attachment mechanism is because the current one takes up a lot of space in the case, which is true. It might be that in order to get a new case shape design, they had to change the strap mechanism to get that extra space.
If they tied them together, then yeah, then either both of them pushed off or neither one. But it's so hard to tell from these rumors because, you know, see previous Apple Watch rumors, they have not been entirely reliable about form factor changes. So
no, they've been comically unreliable. But, you know, if you think about what Apple could do with more interior space of an Apple Watch, the answer is very obvious. Add more battery and therefore give the watch more capabilities and make it, you know, raise the specs basically, and or make it thinner, both of which would be wonderfully welcome for the Apple Watch. I would actually say that they've come far enough in the thinness department in recent minor revisions. I actually don't think it needs to be that much thinner. I'm happy with it where it is. A little bit thinner would be like a little more elegant, but it's not screaming for being thinner.
I think you still have to fight the thinness one, because I think we would all agree an Apple Watch that's one quarter the thickness could be amazing. It opens up a whole new design possibilities, like a really thin one. But we know we just can't do that with current technology. I feel like we need to keep much more so than the phone, because it's not something that you hold in your hand. Thin watches exist and are a good look and are cool, and Apple should pursue that. It is still thicker than, if you said, Apple, we have a magic battery that can be any size and give you the same amount of energy, they wouldn't choose to make it this big. It is thicker than Apple would choose to design. It's thicker than anyone would choose to design. We just know it has to be that big. So I get what you're saying, that it's not so big that it's an impediment, but watches, unlike phones as we know them today, can tolerate being a lot thinner than these things are.
Yes, but it doesn't look like a thick watch. It looks like a kind of regular range of a watch thickness. So like, it doesn't need it. You're right that it would be nice if it's thinner, but like, if they're going to gain a decent chunk of internal volume to use for something, like to spend somehow.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying this year. I'm saying like 20 years from now, Apple shouldn't stop pursuing thinness, because we're never going to get to the 20 years from now really thin watch if they don't continue to pursue it. And the flip side of that is there is obviously the style in the watch industry of, like, it is ridiculously thick because that is the style, and Apple, you know,
well,
continue to pursue
that.
Well,
that's a style.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Ultra fulfills that, but there are very thin watches, and there are also very thick ones, and the thick ones are not thick because they need to be that thick. It is a style, and I feel like the Ultra, that's where the Ultra lives right now, and I'm happy with that one, but for the regular watch, I would love to see it be thinner in a decade rather than the same size.
Yeah, but ultimately what I want to see for the watch is anything that can raise its limits. Like, the entire watch software platform is so extremely limited by its need to conserve power very aggressively, you know, in order to have, you know, useful battery life. And if they can give it, you know, 20% more battery space, whatever it would be, if that would then allow them to let the watch loose a little bit more with its own resource usage, that opens up much more software potential. That opens up potentially like more responsiveness for the user, you know, more on-device features. Like it makes the entire watch experience potentially much better if they can lift some of those limits. So that could pay off in a much bigger way than making it a millimeter thinner, in my opinion.
AirPods 4. I don't have too much to say about this. We have in the show notes that they're supposed to be getting a new design, an updated case, and potentially even active noise cancellation, which I think would be, you know, great for non-AirPods Pro things. Apparently the case will have speakers for Find My Alerts. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Hi, Future Mark. Let me redo that. Apparently the case will have speakers for Find My Alerts. It'll have USB-C, obviously. And then apparently a higher-end version of the AirPods 4, not the Pro, but the AirPods 4 will have ANC, like I said.
AirPods 4 Plus.
Yeah, right. Or 4 Max. I think AirPods 4, that's sounds good. I mean, I don't have any particularly strong thoughts about this. I think I'll probably stick with the AirPods Pro forevermore because they are so freaking good. But I think more of that tech flowing downhill to, you know, regular stuff. I'm here for it. Sounds good to me.
2024 is the year of stuff for me. OLED iPads that no one's really interested in. AirPods 4 that no one's really interested in. But I am, and it's also my iPhone year. I'm a little bit confused by the AirPods 4 rumor with there being two versions, one of which has noise canceling or whatever. Only confused because they haven't come right out and said, oh, by the way, the one that has noise canceling will be shoved into your ear canal, which is not what I want. Right? The reason I use AirPods 3 is I don't want things shoved into my ear canal. If they have two versions of the AirPods 4, surely one of them will not be shoved into my ear canal. I don't know what the word is for this that I keep saying, but anyway, you know what I mean. The little soft, squishy tips that go into the hole in your ear. I don't want that. So if there are two of them, one of them's got to be not like that. But are they also trying to say that the other AirPods 4 will also not go in your ear but have noise canceling? You could do noise canceling, like do the same thing, but not be shoved into your ear canal, but it's not going to work as well at all, right? Just for many, many reasons. But, you know, the rumors are still vague. Anyway, if there are new AirPods, I will probably get them unless both of them go into your ear canals, in which case I'll just ride these out. And I'm willing to believe that I can be converted. If Apple just stops selling the ones that don't go into your ear canals, I'll just have to get used to it. I'll probably survive, but it's not what I prefer. Again, my wife has AirPods Pro. Now she's had two pairs of them, and I've tried them, and I know what they're like. And it's not like I can't do it. I just don't prefer it. I could get used to it if I had to. And I'm sure if I did get used to it, I'd be like, wow, noise canceling is great. Isn't this wonderful? Yeah, you know, all the things everyone else already knows. I just still prefer the other one. So I'm hoping the AirPods 4 with two different models, one or both of them still don't go in your ear canal. And that'll be the one for me as I watch my OLED iPad.
It's a big year for John.
Yeah, all the boring products.
AirPods Max 2, potentially?
Question mark time.
I've never tried the AirPods Max, so I don't have any thoughts on this.
I mean, do they make a USB-C model? Do they actually revise it so they're changed in some way? Do they fix the condensation issue for people with sweaty ears? Do they make them more comfortable? I find them. I've only worn them in Apple stores or whatever, but I do not find them comfortable. It hurts the top of my head with that stupid mesh thing, and it's not what I prefer.
Yeah, the AirPods Max are really great in certain ways, but they could really use a revision. Like, they could really use a version 2 tackling of this problem. You know, they definitely need to get rid of Lightning, of course. We know that. They need the updated processor to have all the newest features of the AirPods Pro, especially at their price. And what I would hope is, what John was alluding to, I would hope they would address comfort a little bit better. The current ones, as talked about many times on the show, they're very heavy, because they use a ton of metal and almost no plastic anywhere in them, and that makes it very difficult to achieve good comfort with headphones. Like, you can have comfortable heavy headphones, but you probably won't. it makes it much harder.
You really need to spread what you'd have to do with heavy headphones. You have to spread the weight over a larger area, and that looks clunky. And it also means there's more crap in contact with your head, which is hotter and sweatier.
Right, and so it is much easier to make comfortable headphones when they are lightweight. And it is much easier to make lightweight headphones when they use a lot less steel and aluminum than Apple used on theirs. And that's, you know, generally that means plastic. Like, that's why when you look at if you look at the competitors to the AirPods Max, the main competitors are the Sony and Bose noise-canceling headphones, both of which use large amounts of plastic in their construction. In part, yes, you can say, oh, because it's cheaper. No, the real reason is because it's better for headphones to be plastic because it's much lighter, and that makes them much more comfortable. Also, of course, the AirPods Max have that terrible case. They don't have a power button. There's all sorts of little other things that I think a revision to this product would be very needed and very welcome, because the other thing about the AirPods Max is that they sound incredible. They sound really good. Their noise cancellation is also really good. Like, they compete well on those factors. It's just all the, like, physical design factors that they really need a lot of help with. So I hope Apple's willing and able to do the kind of update that the product deserves, because, again, they sound so good that it's kind of a shame right now that they are held back in these other factors to a lot of people, because sound-wise, they're amazing.
Can we try to speed run these last four, especially since we're in the question marks here?
HomePod, don't care. Apple TV, yes, please. LLM powered stuff in Apple OS's, sure, why not? And side loading in the EU, we'll see what happens.
It's going to be a good summer for podcasts.
A little bit faster than I expected, but yeah. So for the HomePod and Apple TV, I think that's just a collective shrug. Like, I mostly agree with what Casey said. With the LLM stuff in Apple OS's, this probably should have been hoisted up farther, because 2024 could be the year that Apple rolls out some of the stuff that it's doing. We mentioned at the top of follow-up, they are doing LLM stuff. We know they're doing it. Is this the year some of it comes out? We all hope so, because Siri's crappy, and we think the LLM stuff could make it better. For all the problems with the LLM stuff, anything is better than current Siri. Like really constrain it. Like, have it only help out in certain scenarios. We just want it to work and be smarter than it is. Like, we're so tolerant of Siri's, you know, disloyalty, I don't know, betrayal, non-functionality, that all of the problems that we know are inherent with LLMs will still not be as bad as what Siri does, right? So I really hope that this is the year that, and it doesn't have to be just Siri. That's why I say LLM-powered stuff in Apple OS. There's tons of stuff they could do with it. It could help out with autocorrect. It could try to summarize things for you. And I say on all Apple OS's, they could roll it on the Mac, on the iPad. Like, I'm ready for Apple to roll out something interesting using LLM technology on all of its platforms, even if it's a small thing, because we know that technology has uses. Like, it doesn't solve the world's problems. It's not a quote-unquote AI. It can't even do everything that Siri can do. Like, it's not even ready to step into those shoes. But can it help out a little with autocorrect or search in photos? Yes, I think it can do that. And so whatever those little areas are, especially, you know, again, for something like photos, they could roll that out across all their platforms that Photos exists on. And it wouldn't replace the Photos app. It would just be an existing feature of the Photos app, like search, that suddenly works a little bit better than it used to, thanks to LLM technology that runs locally on your Mac. That's what I'm looking forward to. And then the sideloading and the EU stuff, if nothing comes of that, then we just whatever. But if something comes from it, it could be potentially very interesting, because we've speculated about what would happen if there was ever sideloading the iPhone. And actually seeing it happen, even if it's not in our country, that's time to get some popcorn.
And honestly, what's interesting about the sideloading is, I bet it's not going to be that big of a deal. Like, it'll be a big deal for, like, you know, the podcast and the press and legal. It'll be a big deal for that, for talking about it. But the actual market for, like, who's going to actually do it, I think it's going to, I think Apple, it's going to be much like the, you know, the whole, like, you know, Netherlands dating app thing.
But I was thinking of that scenario, and I think there's a big difference between, like, the dating app scenario where it's like, well, you just have to charge money. Apple will just charge you anyway. I think, again, I don't know the details, but I think this is a scenario where once the sideloading door is open, like, granted, you have to go through it the way Apple says you have to, but I don't think Apple can extract any money from sideloading. So it's not going to be like Netherlands dating app. It's going to be constrained by what Apple does, like whatever hoops they make you jump through. But once you've jumped through those hoops, Apple doesn't get a cut of anything. Apple doesn't, like, it's all sidestepping Apple entirely. If that's not true, then you're right. It's just going to be like Netherlands dating app. Who cares? But what I'm saying is true.
Do we know whether that's true? Like, whether they're allowed to charge a commission or whatever? You know,
we'll see. I don't know the details, but I would imagine that the whole point of this is sideloading is different than using a different payment method when you're selling an app through Apple's own app store. This is like, no, I'm not even using Apple's own app store. The whole point of this is people want to have their own app stores, right? And having your own app store...
I really don't want this to happen.
I know. How can having your own app store make any sense if Apple's allowed to take a cut? So I have to think that once you jump through whatever hurdles that Apple is going to surely put in your path to sideload anything, that Apple is out of that thing. And if that is true, the reason this is interesting is, let's see what happens when the iPhone is open to all the very hungry, sometimes unscrupulous, but sometimes just plain, like, people who are boxed out of the iPhone before. Is there some market need that Apple has not been addressing that will quickly be addressed besides porn, right? But even if it's just porn, like, even if it's just a giant flood of porn coming in the sideloading door on the iPhone, that'll still be interesting, because we haven't seen this platform exposed to the actual market. It's always been mediated through Apple severely. So we don't actually know what's out there and what might come in through the sideloading door. I'm kind of glad it would be happening in the EU and not here, in case, you know, bad things happen. But I'm actually interested in something coming of that. And who knows? With these things, you don't know how long they're going to wind on or whether Apple thinks they're already in compliance and all sorts of other shenanigans. So it's hard to make any hard and fast predictions. But when I was thinking about this, I immediately thought of like, oh, Apple's just going to take their cut. And I'm like, well, wait a second. What if they can't? What if that's the whole point of this thing, that everyone's going to be allowed to have an app store? Like, maybe Steam will be on there, or the Epic App Store. Maybe, like, what will gaming be like on the iPad if you don't have to go through Apple to launch your game? Maybe that's the only way that Apple actually, you know, gets a hold in AAA gaming instead of just their existing mobile gaming, is through the side door of, you know, Steam, the Steam Store and Epic Game Store, side-loaded for EU people only. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think my doomsday scenario that I really don't want to happen is if there's no restrictions for side-loaded stuff, and if you can have side-loaded app stores, then I'm afraid that, you know, some major must-have app provider like Facebook would say, you know what, Instagram, which we know you're all going to install, is no longer on the App Store.
But only in the EU.
You have to download the Facebook App Store and let it, like, root your phone, basically, like that, and you know, have to only go through them. They have no more protections from Apple's rules, and they only have technical protections, which are much weaker than technical and policy protections. Like, so, like, and then me as a developer, do I have to put my stuff in the Facebook store? Like, it's just that.
Only
that,
if you want to sell
me
to people in the EU. That's the whole thing about this being limited.
I know, but I hope that outcome doesn't happen. And what will help keep that from happening is if this stays as small as possible. And maybe it'll just be like, you know, I'm sure Apple will, if they do this, I'm sure they're going to do it in the most reluctant way possible. They're going to only do the bare minimum to satisfy whatever regulation is forcing it. They are going to challenge it at every step. They might, as you said, like, they might say we're already in compliance with some, like, little piddly crap, and they're still taking a 27% commission or whatever else, and then the EU might, like, you know, sue them or whatever. They have to work through all that. Like, so this could be a huge fight for a long time. I don't for a second believe that Apple is going to give any ground that they are not forced to give. So, for instance, I would not expect that they would allow sideloading anywhere else besides the EU. Like, if they don't have to, they won't do it.
Yeah.
And whatever the EU mandate is for sideloading, they're going to do the bare minimum to qualify for that, and they're going to make it as hostile as possible for people to actually do it to ensure no one does it. Whether it's the customer side, excuse me, God, too much Paul Simon. Whether it's the customer side of, like, you know, scary warnings, or whether it's the, you know, legal developer side of you got to give us 27%, or both, they're going to make it so it's really unpleasant for everybody.
And there is that Google case that they lost against Epic that actually is in the U.S. So there are other legal precedents potentially rumbling towards Apple, maybe not next year, but maybe the year after that. So this being confined to the EU for now does not mean it's going to be that way forever.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that sideloading on iOS ends up being as much of a nothing burger as sideloading on Android has been. And, you know, yeah, maybe we'll get a
well,
it was, porn.
It,
maybe
part
we'll
of the
get, like,
part of that
we
Epic
probably,
case,
we
though.
We can probably get emulators, maybe.
Well, but the sideloading on Android has been not a big deal, partially for the reasons that Google just lost that case. Right?
True. Right.
Is that it wasn't naturally that way. Google sort of put its thumb on the scale to ensure that, oh, you can sideload, but you really don't want to do that, do you? That's why they lost that case. So things may change in the future.
Yeah, but from my limited understanding of that case, it seems like Apple would have a lot less to sue them over if they did the same thing.
It's true, but, like, it is, you know, Apple won its case against Epic, and Google so far lost it. Again, these things take forever. They're going to be appealed, blah, 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 but it's something to keep your eye on.
Yeah. And as for the HomePod, I finally reached Casey level. Don't care. Because
there it is.
I'm slowly replacing my HomePods with Sonos gear, and I am much happier for it. They work a lot better. And yeah, you know what? The HomePod is smaller and looks nicer, and in some situations sounds better, but it has broken my heart too many times. The Sonos gear is really reliable. The Alexa assistant on it is rock solid, fast, and reliable. And honestly, I hadn't used Alexa in a while because I threw away my last Echo, the ball one that kept dying and being weird. And Amazon's own devices have ratcheted up the annoyance level over time so much that it's like, by the way, did you know I can annoy you in new and interesting ways if you say this? That most of that seems to be absent on the Sonos version of it. It seems to be like a more limited version of Alexa, which in those ways I think is a feature, not a bug. I have been extremely impressed with the Alexa Assistant's ability to answer general knowledge questions. Questions that I think are somewhat difficult, like for a voice assistant to answer. Like, you know, knowledge, like, you know, one of the recent things was from Adventure Time, we couldn't remember Marceline's dad's name. And so I asked it, you know, from across the room, what is the name of Marceline the Vampire Queen's father? And it got it. It didn't waffle. It didn't say, well, on the web, I found this thing that might be it. No, it just gave me the answer. It was directly correct. The other day, I asked something like, what was the outcome? Oh, my son was asking about Michael Jackson because one of his songs was on. It was asking, like, oh, how did he die? And we mentioned, oh, well, he had this drug thing and his doctor was put on trial. And I asked, first of all, how old was Michael Jackson when he died? If it got that instantly, you know, gave me the straight answer, perfect. And then as Adam was asking about, you know, what happened with his death, I asked something along the lines of, like, what was the outcome of the trial for Michael Jackson's doctor? Figuring, like, that's a pretty tricky question for it to parse, like, it got it. It was perfect. And I was thinking, like, man, asking Siri this kind of question, like, Siri can't even reliably play music when I ask it to play music. Like, whereas, like, Alexa, for all of its faults of, you know, by the way, did you know, it, as a voice assistant, is really solid. It is fast. It is reliable. And it is surprisingly good at general knowledge questions. Not to mention the fact that it kicks butt on, like, timers and all that other stuff, too. So, while it feels kind of gross to like Alexa right now, because I find a lot of the other stuff they do with it kind of distasteful with their own products, as the voice assistant on the Sonos devices, I'm fine with it. I'm totally fine with it. And, you know, AirPlay is so much better on Sonos. The sound quality is really great. The sync, the multi-room stuff is rock solid. Like, I am super happy with the Sonos gear. So, sorry, HomePod. I gave you lots of chances. You blew them all. And I'm done with you.
See, this is what you get for using Siri all this time. I've always been telling you that both Alexa and the Google thing are so much better. I think Google is the best one. Alexa is clearly second, and Siri is so far distant. Third is not even funny. and I still do it. It's the game we still play. I still ask all three. And it's just, we always ask Siri for comic relief. Let's see what Siri does with this. And it's always hilarious. And, you know, Alexa and Google depends on what you're asking. I think Alexa having the IMDb database probably helps a lot with those kind of specific questions that it can answer more directly. But the Google Home, I mean, it's essentially, even if it's all it's doing is essentially running the Google search and reading you that aforementioned top summary thing, that is often close to being the answer. Although, as both of these things start to get LLM powered, now I start to go, it would be nice, the Amazon thing, if you told me whether you used LLM to come up with that Michael Jackson age of death, because I would prefer if you didn't, because I'm sure you could give me a plausible age, but now I have to go to the Wikipedia page to check what the actual age was. You know what I mean? Like, well, honestly, I don't want to not trust it because it's LLM stuff, because LLM can give you a plausible answer to all sorts of stuff, but I want to know, is this an answer that comes from, I can't even characterize it. It's like, in the days before LLM, the only way you could give that answer is by pulling it off some well-known web page or a database indexing that you have. But now, LLMs can give you that answer with zero knowledge. They don't have to know it, and if they do know it, they don't have to give it to you. They just produce something that is plausible, statistically plausible, and lots of answers could be statistically plausible. And you, as the user, are like, oh, great, it gave us the exact age. The whole point is you didn't know the age. That's why you asked. So you haven't, unless it tells you, like, 2 or 97, if it's within a plausible range, you're going to be like, I guess that's the answer. And pretty soon, that's not going to be as true as it is today, which is kind of sad.
I think we are lucky in that. I think running LLM inference is still much more expensive than
running the cheap search index lookup.
So, like, whatever they've already built that didn't use LLMs is probably so much cheaper to run queries against.
Yeah, no, if you ask something about, like, movies or TV or whatever, doing a reasonable search of the Internet Movie database and giving you the answer that way with a little bit of intelligence is so much better than saying, we threw a bunch of crap into this LLM and stuff comes out sometimes. Isn't that cool? Just do the database lookup.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Notion and Trade Coffee. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week.
The ad is gone. See, it didn't take long. New year, no more at.
No, that was fast. I
yeah, it's just, I told you, it's just not natural. And here's another post-show since you didn't do it in the pre-show. We still have pint glasses left over from the holiday sale. We have like a dozen of them. If you want a pint glass, go buy one because they're there. There's on-demand stuff as well, but you shouldn't buy from the on-demand store because you're a listener to the show and you know to wait for the real sales where the shirt's better quality and are more expensive. Anyway, atp.fm/store. Get one of the last dozen pint glasses, please. Take them.
But I gotta say, the Pixel shirt is really nice. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah, it
turned
really
out
good.
Really good.
Yep, it's neat. And I did enjoy it. Like, I got a bunch of stuff for my family as well. Like, the different varieties we got, like the long sleeve and the sweatshirts and stuff. People are wearing them. Like, people who are kind of sick of the t-shirts in my own family, they're like, ah, no, I'll try a sweatshirt. My wife is wearing an ATP, it's just the ATP logo black sweatshirt. Just, she's wearing it as her pajamas today. So, you know. I'm glad we branched out a little bit and went into some new products. And yeah, the Pixel shirt is cool. You can't get any of that stuff anymore. Sorry, but you can get a couple pint glasses.
Do you do any kind of like New Year's resolution or Cortex style themes?
No.
Nope.
Definitely not.
Well, I mean, I listen to the show where they talk about them. Does that count?
Yeah,
as
right, exactly.
Yeah, that counts a little bit. Yeah.
I listen and think, boy, how unlike me that they are.
They're very regimented. No, I've often felt like I frequently align with Gray's theme. So for listeners, if for some reason you don't listen to Cortex, the gist of that we're talking about is that CGP Gray came up with this. I think he was the one who started it. Like this,
but I thought it was Mike who came up with it.
With the theme?
It's hard to. Yeah,
I think it was. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So they came. It's a thing Cortex does every year where rather than like a New Year's resolution, which. And our friend Merlin has very successfully argued against New Year's resolutions over time of being like fairly dysfunctional and generally, you know, considered harmful in the sense that, you know, it's tricky. Resolutions are usually setting yourself up to fail pretty effectively and pretty shortly, and then you just feel bad about yourself as opposed to what you know, Gray, Mike, and Cortex do is like, more setting a theme for the year to kind of guide your thinking and work over the year, as opposed to a resolution that's like, I'm going to, you know, as an example, like instead of saying like, I'm going to lose 20 pounds by June, you know, like that's a specific goal. You can call it a resolution. But that's the kind of thing that's like, it's very easy for that kind of thing to fail. You also tend to know early on in the year how much you failed at it, and you might then like fall off the wagon and go back to your old habits or whatever. Whereas a theme could be more like health. Like, I'm going to make this the year of improving my health. That is something that it's hard to distinctly fail at. I mean, unless you die, I guess. But like, you know, like it's hard. Sorry. Like, it's hard to like outright fail to the point where you're discouraged from continuing. And it's more like, I'm going to make decisions throughout the year thinking of this as a guiding principle. And so it seems to be much more effective. And my apologies to the Cortex podcast if I have any of this wrong or if I'm mischaracterizing it. But I think
there's a YouTube video that explains it pretty well. If we can find that for the notes, we'll put it in. But if not, just search YouTube for Cortex yearly themes.
Yeah. And I think it's a really nice system. It's a really nice reframing of this kind of thing that we do, like getting away from the resolution thing. Because, again, resolutions are so...
Did you ever do resolutions?
I've done them here and there, and I usually forget, like, by the second week of January. I even forget what it was.
You forget or you fail them? Or, like, are you losing interest?
Yes.
Like,
generally, all both. All three. But, yeah, it's I like the idea of the themes, and I oftentimes line up with Gray's themes.
But do you do your own thing? You like the idea of them, and when you hear Gray's themes, you're like, oh, that seems like a good idea. But do you actually ever like say, this is going to be my theme for the year? Even if you're saying, I'm going to adopt Gray's theme, and I'm going to do that this year too.
Generally, for the last few years, generally, yes, I have kind of set a theme. But sometimes
where do you record that?
I forget what it is, and it might change it like 6 months.
You got to write it down.
That's a great theme.
But generally speaking, like last year, I kind of had the guiding principle of, like, closing open projects because my life was full of open projects.
Yeah, you know, not anymore,
house,
though, right?
Right.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, like, moving, house renovation, like, all that stuff. Like, it just was there was so much going on, and it was very overwhelming. This year, I'm making it the year of Overcast. because Overcast has really suffered the last couple years in that, like, I've had all this other life stuff going on. I have not been able to give it a lot of time, and it needs it badly. And so I actually have turned that around substantially in the last few months. Like, I'm giving Overcast way more time in the last few months, and I'm not only am I making good progress on the big rewrite, but I'm also just much happier. Like, it had been so long since I really had a lot of good programming work done, so I'm much happier doing this now. So I'm really making this year the year of Overcast. I'm going to get the rewrite out this year. It's going to be a ton of work. There's still a ton to do. I can't tell you when this year it's coming out because I am no better at estimating software timing than anyone else.
That's the thing about themes. The theme doesn't say that it's the year I'm going to ship the new version of Overcast. It just says year of Overcast. And I would say, based on listening to all the theme episodes over the years, that that's probably a little bit too specific for a theme. But still, it not being so specific to say the year I launched the rewrite of Overcast, it is more general than that, but I bet you could go one level more general if you needed to. But since you're not, this is not an official Cortex brand theme. This is just a Marco's adoption. And by the way, now you have recorded it in a place. You haven't written it down in a theme system journal or even a notes document, but you do have recorded it on this podcast.
No, I can't use paper.
Casey will forget about it, but I won't.
That's correct.
The theme system journal looks like a really nice product that I would not use because I don't use paper.
Yeah, we have
computers. It looks really nice, though.
People who like paper, but every time I see those things, it's like, this is the whole reason I like computers. I don't have to do things on paper.
I wish I liked paper and pens and stuff. It looks so cool. Like, the whole world looks so cool, and you get all these nice notebooks.
To see my own handwriting, that's not cool.
Yeah, I guess that's the problem. Like, every time I handwrite anything now, like, God, this sucks. I just want to type things.
You're writing everything in graffiti. I know, it's terrible.
Yeah, nice pull. My Palm 5X is
all
broken.
Your A's not have crosses on them. I don't know how to write anymore. Yeah. I just do graffiti. I write all the letters in the same spot on top of each other, and then I can't read it later.
Oh my gosh.
No, but you know, with like setting the goal as, or setting the theme as Overcast, I'm intentionally being a little too specific with that because that's the level of focus it needs this year. Like, you know, if I would instead say something like the year of work, like that is a valid thing. I think that was Gray's last year one.
No, that was a Year of New Decades Dawn sequel.
Whatever. So, like,
it wasn't actually. This is just an inside joke. Anyway, their theme, the titles of their themes have had varying quality over the years.
Yes, but like, you know, like it, you know, in certain years you might want to, like, you know, open new opportunities. In certain years you might want to focus on you know, closing opportunities or focus on the ones you have. Like, there can be more broad themes. For me, this year the theme needs to be Overcast. Like, it is a huge part of my income. It is like my main business. It is also my main product that I craft. Like, it is the only, it's the main thing I work on as a programmer, because, you know, I don't work on the CMS. it's very important to me, and it has been neglected. Like, I have neglected it because I have been spending too much time doing other work or other needs in my life, and this year is when I need to get back to it, and it makes me confident that I can do it, that I've already been swinging back to it for like a month, and it's been going very well.
A month? You've been doing it. I think you've been swinging back to it for a while now. But although this theme, like, obviously Cortex is about productivity and people's work lives or whatever, but themes don't necessarily have to be focused on work life, which is another reason that Overcast is maybe a little bit too specific. And you will hear themes from the two of them that are not absolutely confined to one of the many things they do as part of their work. Obviously, health would be an example of that, because that's, you know, not work related. It's, you know, something you're focusing on yourself. But I'm always waiting for like a yearly theme that has nothing to do with any of their jobs, right? Like Year of Romance, right? You could apply that to some of their work as well. But like, always the themes are like a thing that applies to one of my businesses and also my life. And I guess health is the closest they've come. But like, you know, anyway, this is not going to be the Year of Romance for me any more than any previous years were, because I don't do themes.
Yeah,
I would suggest that for people. Someone should pick that up. Year of Romance. It's out there. Who's going to be brave enough to pick it up? What? Mike, Gray, who's not listening?
Right. Also true. And I, all kidding aside, I really like the idea of a yearly theme, but I don't feel like I have ever landed on one that I can really grab onto and say, yes, this was what I want for this year. And that's not their fault. That's my fault. But I can't get there. And I'm also not disciplined enough. So let's say that this year was the year of work and then I decide that I just want to get distracted by, I don't know, wiring the house for Ethernet and fiber and whatnot.
You could have had past themes, like, again, themes that are not focused on work. You could have had year of reproduction. You could have had multiple years of reproduction.
Yes. Well, in that sense, I think you did.
I think you did have multiple years of reproduction.
We had probably, what, like 5 years of reproduction?
Yearly themes. I mean, it is aspirational, and it is a thing that you went through that is difficult, that would guided all your decisions for a long period of time. You just didn't write it down in a little book.
I mean, I guess that's true. But I view, even though I agree with everything you're saying, that the yearly theme by no means has to be work-related, I do view it as it should be work involved, even if it's not specifically for work. And I don't know, I don't feel like I am good enough and disciplined enough to stick with it. And I think that if they were here to argue with us, they would say, well, it's not about discipline. It's just about guiding your actions and guiding your thoughts. And that's fair.
Yeah, it's what you make of it, but, I think, largely.
Yeah, right.
And that's by design.
And I don't know, I feel like if this year was the year of, I don't know, perfecting call sheet, which is again too specific, I can't even think of a good example because I can't think
you're
of anything.
Living dangerously, there's one for you.
Yeah, well how would you live dangerously, John Syracuse? So would you leave the house every once in a while?
Coke instead of spray.
Leaving the house all the time.
Yeah, but you won't come to New York when two-thirds of the podcast is there. I'm still grumpy. Still grumpy, John.
You were there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Your reason could have been to see some of your great friends that you haven't seen in five friggin' years or whatever.
You know, just wait until we all get invited to an Apple event.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure.
Any day.
You would fucking go anyway. There's no chance.
I would go. I'm ready. Apple. I'm out here. I'm ready to go to Apple events.
Would you? Sure. So if they have a big Vision Pro event and invite all of us, which I guarantee you is not going to happen, but if that's for some reason happened, would you go?
Yeah, no, ever since I've been out of my jobby job, I've been prepared to go to things that I get invited to by Apple, and the one time it happened, I had to demur because I had my son's high school graduation, and then since then, I've never been invited, so I'm just out here waiting. And I'm sorry, I wanted to go to my son's high school graduation, so sue me. It's like, and if my daughter's going to graduate soon too, and not this year, but next year, I'm going to go to that graduation too, Apple. So don't invite me on the day that she's going to have her high school graduation. But barring that, I'm ready to go to Apple events. I still haven't even been to Apple Park. I still want to go.
Oh, it's really cool.
I'm sure it is, if only someone would invite me.
I love Apple Park so much.
Speaking of Apple Park stuff, the Infinite Loop Apple Store is closing, and I was like, well, I don't care, like, whatever. But I know they have unique things or whatever. But anyway, I got someone sent me photos of the shirts that are available just before the Infinite Loop Apple Store goes away, and some of them are cool, so I'm going to get some of them. I'll send you the picture. There's designs that are cool for me. I'm going to get three new shirts from the Infinite Loop Apple Store before it goes away. Three designs I hadn't seen before.
A friend of mine had sent me offerings within the last month or so, and I don't remember being that impressed by them, to be honest.
I mean, they appeal to me. Like, maybe they want
to appeal
to
you. That's fair.
Are they all black?
No.
That's more Marco style or former Marco style.
No, but whenever we launch a shirt, John insists of having, like, you know, a flat black, non-heathered version, you know.
It's not just black. I like non-heathered versions of every color.
You're missing out on all the wonderful softness.
I'm
going to
have some of them, too. I got a lot of shirts. Let's see. Let's see if this works.
You got to add them to the archive.
Right.
All right. This go through?
All right. I got it. No.
Yep. All right. So we're looking at a bunch of shirts on display. There's a six-colored Apple shirt on black and on white. There's the Apple logo with Park following it on black and on white. There's a old school serif. What font is that?
Palatino.
Thank you. Six colors, just the word Apple, black and white. There's the original Mac. It looks like an artist rendering with the hello on it. Again, black and white. There's Macintosh. And is that Helvetica? Or is that Palatino as well?
No, it's Palatino.
Helvetica is not a serif font.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm an idiot. It's late. What are you going to do? Anyway, Macintosh. There's that. What do you call that, like, squiggly?
Picasso Mac.
There you go. Thank you. There's designed by Apple in California, underlined in six colors. And then there's the old, old, old school Apple logo with the six colors and the Apple at a 45-degree angle. All these shirts available in black and white. I mean, they're nice, but there's nothing here that, for me, I'm like, yes.
But which ones appeal to me? Which ones did I pick?
I'm guessing you picked the old Mac, like the...
Yep.
Probably the maybe the Picasso.
Yep.
And probably the Apple Rainbow and Palatino logo.
I was close on the Palatino logo, but I was like, eh, they didn't tend to do that with their logo.
No, you went for the six colors at a 45-degree angle.
The one I was questioning is just the one that just says Macintosh, mostly because, as we've discussed in the past, the word Macintosh is not as prominent in anything from Apple as it used to be. It's in Macintosh HD, I think, still, but all their computers are just plain Macs. We know it's short for Macintoshes, but used to be the computers were called Macintosh. It was, you know, Macintosh SE. It wasn't Mac SE, right? The box said Macintosh. For the longest time, they did that, and eventually it just became Mac. So I kind of like seeing the word spelled out. I think that's kind of the point of that shirt.
Yeah,
but nice. The text looked a little bit big, and it was boring. So what I'm getting instead is, I love the classic Mac one so much with the Mac Paint Hello thing on it. I got that in black and in white, and then I got the Picasso in white.
Nice. By the way, there's a dispute in the chat room.
I was going to say, can we get ahead of this before we get a trillion emails?
They are saying that the old Apple font is
Apple. They're right. What I'm thinking of is when you had a Mac and you wanted to make text that looked like the logo, Palatino was the font that you had, but there's Apple's variant of Garmont. You're right. They're right. Okay. Chat room is right. Sorry. Thanks for the corrections. We don't have to hear about this.
We will still.
I forget what was different about their particular variant, but it was slightly tweaked. I remember using Palatino because he always wanted to make text that looked like the Apple marketing material. And I guess if you had this font or if you bought it from Adobe, but I was just a kid, so I just had what came with the computer, and Palatino was the closest.
All right. Titles.
Man, you're so much older than me. Like when I was making Apple fonts, it was Myriad Pro. Like that was
many fonts later. What you missed was the exciting days. You all missed the exciting days when the system font in the Macintosh operating system started changing. It was Chicago from 1984 for a while, and then Apple started changing it. And for a couple of years, they would change. I know we changed to Mac OS X. What was it originally? You don't remember this either, but it's
Lucidogram?
The Helvetica Neu, whatever now, I think.
Yeah,
no, it's San Francisco now, right?
It was only Helvetica, I think, for one release. It was Lucidogram for the whole
time. That's right. That was the original Mac one. And then, of course, now we have San Francisco everywhere. San Francisco is great, but Chicago, you know, as we've discussed in the past, was designed so that you could knock out every other pixel and still read the text, because that's how you got grayscale on a monochrome screen. And that heavily influenced the font. That's why it's so hilarious to see outline versions of Chicago used on signs in the real world now. It's like, wow, that font is not... That font has found itself in places that it never expected to be. But they did SB Sans. They did Charcoal. Appearance Manager lets you change the system font across... You could change it to ridiculous things across the whole system. Those were crazy days. But no more.
Couldn't you do that with Windows? Couldn't you like change your font to Wingdings and really mess up your whole system?
Probably
like with registry hacks and stuff like that. And you could change it with like resource hacks on the Mac, but Appearance Manager was an officially supported Apple framework for doing exactly that, that Apple kind of wimped out on at the last minute. But it was still in the operating system, so everyone took advantage of it with third-party utilities. But it wasn't like they were hacking it, like with Shapeshifter and all this stuff in Mac OS X. It was like, no, this is an official Apple framework that controls how everything is drawn, and you can hook into it. And it was great. That's why I follow that account on the Mastodon and used to on Twitter that just shows old Kaleidoscope themes that leverage this framework to change everything on the system. All right, titles.
I like a Rights laundering machine. I like I'm not the only
one. We've done something like that before, so I'm going to skip that one.
All right. I like I'm not the only old person, and I like the 1.0-iest of 1.0s.
There was a Casey title in here somewhere.
What was the only old person thing about? I don't remember that.
It was two kinds of glasses.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad. I think we can probably do better.
Yeah, I thought that was a...
I can boot the
I finally reached Casey level. It's pretty good.
Oh, I love the Linux thing. You're never going to boot into Linux on your Mac Pro. Are you nuts? Like,
no, like,
you're never
going to
do that.
No, because that's what the Steam Deck runs. The Steam Deck runs Linux. And
I understand the logic of what you're saying, but I'm with Marco. There's no freaking way you'll do it.
Well, I boot into Windows. You think I like Linux less than Windows? That is not the case. I would much rather put my Mac into Linux than Windows. I just go to Windows because that's where the games are. There was someone doing benchmarks recently where they were benchmarking like the quote-unquote same game running under Linux and running under Windows 11, and it was faster under Linux.
Oh, wow.
Which is that the level that their, you know, compatibility shim layer. Next time we talk about gaming, we'll talk more about this. But, like, you know, Valve is all in on, like, we're going to make Windows games work in Linux through this hack thing. And Apple is like, we have a porting toolkit, but don't use it to ship games. I like The Year of Romance. That's my favorite title.
That is pretty good.
Because no one's going to know what the hell that's about. We do Year in Review, and they're going to be like, when are they going to talk about The Year of Romance?
That is pretty good.
That might be our best one.
Yep, you've sold me. I was gonna pitch a couple others pretty hard, but no, I think you've sold me on this. All right, The Year of Romance.
The first 2024 episode is The Year of Romance, and you'll hear us talk a lot about the Vision Pro. Like, what? Are they talking about porn on the Vision Pro? What?
Yeah, that's going to be a whole use case that we're just going to not talk about. Like, we're going to everyone apparently uses the Meta headsets for that. Like, whenever we talk, every time we talk about the Meta headsets, and we're always like, well, people don't really use them for much, someone always has to tell us, you know, they're really popular for porn. Like, it's like, yeah, okay.
So are computers.
Yeah, I mean,
as you heard. Computers of all kinds. I don't know, I'm sure the Apple Watch has gotten in on it, but probably, you know.
I'm sure someone has found a way.
Someone's figured it out, found a way.
But can you imagine like a sadder situation than like spending $3,500?
Hey, everyone's got to have hobbies.
I guess. I mean, I shouldn't judge, but like, man.
Spend money on what's important to you.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Hey.
Oh, God. All right. I guess we're
good. Goodbye, live people.
Yeah, cool. Bye, live people. Thank you for being live people. And I believe we are back to a normal schedule for a while now.
As far as I know, that's right.
We will see you next week. Same time, same place.